Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Members, the clerk will take the roll. There is a quorum. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just thought that this group ought to have an official opening for the meeting this morning.
I was hoping we could have the band, like, you know, march through, out, in, out, you know, that would...
Hopefully we could have Representative Eric do a little cheerleading.
Well, I got my skirt on.
Or at least have Goldie Goldberg here this morning.
Yeah. All right, wow, we're all in a fine mood this morning. Okay, members, I've got the minutes of the April 4th meeting before us. Are there any corrections or changes to those minutes? Seeing none, Representative Earhart moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, our schedule for today is we're going to take up the Gophers Bill first. We will then be taking up the targets. We will then take up the Emmer Residency Bill. If necessary, we may come back after session. I'm not planning on running all the way to session at 3 o'clock, but I know there are other people that have committee obligations and meetings and such, but we will do at least the first two this morning, and we'll see about the other one afterwards. With that, Representative Abrams, Representative Solberg, Representative Abrams, I assume, moves that House File 263 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I did not say yesterday is that this is indeed a legislative partnership, and my partner in moving this bill forward is Representative Lauren Solberg, would like to make a very brief statement. I understand he has someplace else he has to go, but I know the Representative Solberg feels strongly about this issue and would like him as the co-author to have an opportunity.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Abrams. I guess I've been, if we were going to do one particular stadium, that this should be our first priority in the state of Minnesota, because the University of Minnesota is a state institution and is our flagship university that has a great deal of influence on the economics of the state. I had the opportunity as a young kid from the farm in northern Minnesota to spend time at the university, and I would like to be able to rewrite history and say that we should have never torn down the old Memorial Stadium, but we can't do that. So we have to play the deck of cards that we are dealt with today. I had the opportunity to do two things in my career at the University of Minnesota besides some other things that I'm probably not so proud of. But one of them was to participate in hanging the Coach Warmath in effigy in one year and then carrying him on our shoulders the next year when we went to the Rose Bowl. So I do think that football and the stadium on the campus is an extremely important element of the university life. It was when I was attending there. I wish we could go back and rewrite history and never have torn down Memorial Stadium, worked with that, but that's not reality today. So I think we need to now go forward and try our best to come up with a package that will make sense to everybody and get this off our plate and get the football back on the campus. With that, I thank you very much, and thanks, Representative Abrams, for inviting me.
All right. Members, we did have a good discussion of the stadium bill yesterday, and Representative Abrams, I don't know if you want to go over the bill again briefly for the members that are here that were not able to attend yesterday, or if we should just go to amendments. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, looking at the length of your agenda and the three-hour discussion we had yesterday, and members were in and out of the room, so I think they've got a pretty good flavor. I think we should go just to the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Members, there will certainly be plenty of opportunity for people to ask questions if they wish about the bill as we especially finish off with the amendments, but let's go to amendments. Members, first I'd like to move the A-15 amendment. Chair moves the A-15 amendment. This is an issue we discussed yesterday in that the $9.4 million per year payment the state is making to the university, there's actually nothing in the bill that talks about how long the payment is. I guess it was always understood to be 25 years, but not put into the bill, and so I felt that it would be good to make sure we had something in the bill in regard to that. And I've talked to the university about it, and of course they can speak for themselves, but I think they're okay with this. Representative Abrams?
Mr. Chairman, it's a good amendment, and it brings up kind of another issue that it may not be as high as $9.4 million a year. That's the outside number. If interest rates are lower than 5.5%, with which the university based its calculation, the $9.4 million number would be less, but I think this is a good clarifying amendment.
Discussion of the A-15 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment does say up to, so it...
Yes, it does.
It would qualify, but the author was commenting on...
Yeah, the amendment does say up to, so it does take into account that issue Representative Abrams raised, which I'm glad he mentioned as an aside on it. Say no further discussion. All in favor of the A-15 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, members, I think next I'll take the A-13 amendment, and I'm not sure whose that is. Representative Kelleher moves the A-13 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, and I think Representative Abrams remembers this issue from capital investment. This is an issue of making sure that the Regents consider other uses of the stadium when it's not in use by the university football team or another university use, such as possibly high school football, maybe other soccer. There's some other possibilities there. Representative Hausman raised this issue in capital investment, and we promised that we would work on it and find a way to at least direct the Board of Regents to consider the options for other public uses here, particularly youth sports uses. And, Mr. Chair, I think it's important that the President and I talked beforehand about that this is actually... this is important to the university, actually, in terms of recruiting kids to the university, both sports programs and otherwise, as an outreach mission.
Discussion to the A-13 amendment. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, this is a good amendment. The Board of Regents already has in place a policy for the use of its facilities. I believe the top priority is to further the education mission of the University of Minnesota. Second, the recreational needs of the students at the University of Minnesota. And third is other public bodies. And then at the bottom of the list is private events. So I think what Representative Kelleher's amendment does is it simply restates a policy that probably ought to be restated.
Other discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A-13 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A-13 amendment is adopted. Members, let's next go to the A-12 amendment, which I believe is an amendment of Representative Abrams. Representative Abrams moves the A-12 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A-12 amendment basically does three or four things. First, on page 2, line 24, it makes clear that the recreational uses of the land for the DNR are those that are named in Minnesota Statute Section 86A03 Subdivision 2, which is our basic wildlife management statute. There's a couple clarifying amendments dealing with the Department of Natural Resources, and then there is the deeding of the property, and it would be a deed without warranties. And on the environmental issue, which was somewhat mangled in the original drafting. I think that this language does what current law is, which is that the state would, for any environmental claims, step into the shoes of the university for the pollution that occurred on the property prior to the university's acquisition of it in 1947. Does not absolve the University of Minnesota for anything that occurred past. It doesn't indemnify the University of Minnesota. I think that this language is a lot better. I know it's been worked out between the university and the General Counsel's office and was it Department of Natural Resources or the Attorney General's office? What the Department of Resources.
A discussion to the 8th-12 Amendment. Our Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand what you're doing here. The piece that feels like it is missing is the requirement that the university pursue due diligence when it is working with the federal government to get this land cleaned up. And I don't see any due diligence language in here. So if we're absolving them of, I mean, I know what you're doing here with regard to the law, but it also could be used as an excuse not to pursue due diligence. And I was wondering if you could work on language that would require that.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Abrams,
I would ask counsel to first. I'd like to have the amendment put on, but I would like if somebody from House Research is here to put in a sentence that would say that the university will promptly endeavor to resolve its claims against the federal government for contamination and pollution on university land, which occurred prior to transfer. And if we put that sentence in, Representative Wagenius, I think we got it, but I think that that's a good suggestion. So council can kind of work on that as we go through some of the other stuff. That's a good suggestion.
Representative Abrams, perhaps we can have council work on that. I have at least three other people that want to talk to this amendment,
okay,
so we may be able to get this dealt with by the time we vote on the amendment. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, did you say this is current law? Did you reference something like that?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorman, it is close to current law, I think is the way to put it, in that if I were pursuing a claim, I have a responsibility to first go after the responsible party. In this case, the responsible party is the United States government. And I think that that's basically what the language here does. We do have Mr. Larson from the General Counsel's Office of the University, who's a little bit more up on environmental law than I am, Representative Dorman.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams.
Representative Dorman.
If it's close to current law, or why do we need this provision? Why would the state want to do this?
Mr. Larson from
the Mr. Larson, welcome back to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dorman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, under present Minnesota state law, an owner of land is responsible for contamination that they are associated with. So the mere fact that one owns land isn't enough to make one responsible for the contamination on that land under state law. If we went to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, it would be our hope, even though there's certainly no guarantee, that we would be able to get what's called a no association letter from the MPCA and a no action letter from the MPCA recognizing that the contamination that was put on the land during federal government ownership was not the university's problem to solve. What this language does, though, is it makes that recognition now of something that's quite self-evident, that before the university owned the land, it did not contaminate the land and should not be held responsible for the contamination caused by others. As to contamination created by the university during its period of ownership, there's no effect at all. The university has whatever legal responsibility it has for that and will continue to have that responsibility.
Representative Dorman? Follow up?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I still then am wondering why, if what you're saying is true, why do we need this provision?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Gorman, Mr. Chairman, what it does is, I mean, first of all, there's no assurance that the university would actually get the administrative letters from the MPCA. And what it does is it gives the university comfort in the fact that as between the University of Minnesota and the State of Minnesota, that the State of Minnesota will not make a claim against the University of Minnesota for the contamination. Now, if someone else brought a lawsuit naming the university for contamination on that land, the university would defend that lawsuit. The university would not go and ask the State of Minnesota to indemnify it as the prior language that was stricken before had. Similarly, once the state takes ownership of the property, if someone were to start a lawsuit claiming that the State of Minnesota was responsible for the contamination that was on the land caused by the Department of Defense, the State of Minnesota would defend that lawsuit. If both of us were named in that action, we would both go in and defend that lawsuit. But what it does is it gives us some assurance that what we believe we're entitled to under state administrative rules would in fact come to fruition as part of an overall transaction with the state involving the stadium.
Definitely we're not liable.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, I'm not a lawyer to understand this, but I'm concerned that we're giving up, we're taking on a huge liability and we're paying retail or whatever for the land. I don't know what we're really paying for the land per se and what we're paying for the whole deal, but it's, you've got a dollar invested, we're giving them current value or something approximating that. All it just does is it gets you off the hook and puts us on the hook. And maybe that's fine, but maybe this should have been heard in the Environment Committee so they could have vetted this out a little bit more, but I'm uncomfortable with taking on that liability along with the rest of the liability we're taking on to pay this large amount of money, so I don't know where to go with that. Wanted to express that.
Okay, members, I have Representatives Klinzing, Dempsey, Sikora, Lagenius, and Kelleher. Representative Klinzing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there a telephone pole treatment manufacturing that happened on this land that's being purchased or exchanged?
Representative Abrams.
I was getting some other information. Representative Plankton, could you repeat, please?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there were telephone poles that were cut and treated on this land and if they have anything to do with the pollution and that's not connected to the Army Corps of Engineers.
Representative Abrams, or...
We have the manager of all sorts of university properties with us who can give a definitive answer.
Representative Knobloch, Representative Klinzing, I'm the Vice President for Agricultural Policy, and I believe that there was wood floors of the ordnance storage facilities that was made out of creosote-treated wood on the site during the 1944-45 period of time. I don't believe there's any telephone pole manufacturing, but the wood that was treated with creosote on the site during that period of time.
Representative Klinzing.
Thank you. And if that if any chemicals or pollution leaked from those floors into the land, would that be the responsibility of the Army Corps of Engineers or not?
Mr. Musselplatt.
Representative Clinton, I believe that is the responsibility of the Army Corps of Engineers and the federal government.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Larson. Line 1.13, it says, otherwise came to be located on adjacent to the university, and lines 1.11 and 1.12, I'm just a little bit concerned. Can you tell me the essence of the meanings of that statement?
Mr. Larson.
Representative Dempsey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the intention of that language was that contamination can show up on a site, and now we're talking about the 2,840 acres in a couple of different ways. One way is that someone literally goes out there and sets it down on the site. And so, for example, Could someone carry a barrel of something and put it on the land? That's one way that it gets there. A second way it gets there, though, is activities on land that are adjacent or nearby, and then because of rain and wash from the land or something like that, it comes to be located on the 2,840 acres that we're talking about. So that's the intent of that language.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sikora.
My question was asked, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Dorman brings up an issue that just in tightening this language, besides requesting due diligence, I think what you want to be careful about that you're not indemnifying for something that happens on a parcel that is not being conveyed. And it seems to me that this may be broad enough to have that kind of indemnity. And so the language, it seems to me, needs to be tightened up on line 1.11. It's the university land that is the subject of this bill. It's not all of the university land. And that otherwise came to be located needs to be gotten rid of, because that is the plume coming from the site from above, mm-hmm. underneath the groundwater. So what we should be dealing with is only the parcel of land that is being conveyed, mm-hmm. and any notion of indemnity should be gotten rid of.
Okay,
Representative Abrams.
Representative Wagenius, if you go back to page 2 of the bill, mm-hmm. subdivision 6, it specifies that the university land is only that 2,800 acres. So I think that as far as that point that you make, I think it was already taken care of by the definition.
Okay.
Additionally, Mr. Chair, as I have the amendment, first is a technical change on line 1.6, it should have after the second Minnesota, which would be a technical change. And as to the sentence to tighten up the obligation of the university to resolve its claims against the federal government, a sentence could be added that would state, the university shall promptly endeavor to resolve its claims against the federal government with respect to environmental contamination that occurred prior to the time the university took title to the university land. So that, I think, gets to the point that Representative Wagenius made, which is, we don't want it to just convey the land and do nothing about these claims. It would require them to immediately go and try to resolve the claims.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wagenius.
That's correct for one of my points, but okay. My other point is on line 1.13.
Okay.
When it says, we're looking at where the pollutants came from, when it says, or that otherwise came to be located on or adjacent to the university,
mm-hmm.
that seems to mean that we are indemnifying for the pollutants that came from the site to the north, something we cannot do under mm-hmm. our Constitution. So I would ask that you would remove...
or adjacent.
That came to be located on or adjacent. Yes, the adjacent at the minimum, I think.
Okay, Representative. I'm looking to somebody who practices law in this area. It has been years since I have. Is there any objection to taking out the subjective phrase or adjacent? I don't know what that is. Mr. Larson?
If I could speak to him now.
Mr. Larson, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lavinius, the language that is in the amendment is not indemnification language. Instead, it's the state will not make a claim against the university. With indemnification language is if somebody makes a claim against the university would ask the state, step into our shoes and go and do something. This is not indemnification language. It's actually release language. And so we're just saying the state won't make a claim against the university. We're not authorizing the university to ask the state to do anything. An important point here is to speak to something else that you raised in the other part of the amendment. The university has been actively engaged in discussions with the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Vice President Musket and others have traveled to Washington and worked with the United States representative for the 2nd District that includes this land and has had meetings with the Army Corps of Engineers and the like. So the university is actively pursuing and is committed to continually pursuing that remedy that's there.
Representative Lavinius.
So you answered, you made answers to questions that I didn't ask. I'm asking about the language, or adjacent to. I don't think that we can put that language in this amendment. I think that language should be deleted, and I will so move to delete or adjacent to. What we want to, we do not want to say that the state can't make claims with regard to the lands to the north. If the lands to the north are contaminating the lands to the south.
Yeah. Representative Anderson, what's that? She's talking about page 1, line 13. Yep. Okay, Representative Lavinius moves that on page 1, line 13, the words or adjacent to be stricken. Is that correct, Representative Lavinius?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, my original instinct is correct that I think we can take out that phrase, so I would certainly incorporate that change into the amendment, Representative Lavinius.
I appreciate that, Representative Abrams.
Okay, the Lavinius oral amendment is incorporated on page 1, line 13, strike or adjacent to. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just want to, we talked about this particular section of the bill, and we took it out in bonding, if you remember, Representative Dorman, because it was very clunky, and it really didn't tell us anything about how we were protecting the state. And I think this is much more clear. I think the issue here, folks, is that I really would still like the Attorney General's office to look at this in particular, because I didn't hear that said in the beginning, and I know in the last committee we talked about that, that we would have someone who does this sort of law for the state review this to make sure that we are protecting ourselves in terms of the pre-1947 date as well as the post-1947 date. And the issue here is, members, we're not, we are still able, if it is found at some point that after 1947 in the use of the land that the university contaminated the land, we would still be able to pursue redress from the university over this issue. The issue is that prior to 1947 is the federal government, and we need to be able to say to the university and be clear about that, that they will seek the redress from the federal government. So I think the language is much better, Representative Abrams. I still would prefer that before we get to the floor with this bill that we have someone, I will suggest Alan Williams, in the Attorney General's office look at the language just to be sure and make sure that we are protecting ourselves and protecting the interest of the state, because I think that's a big part of what our job is here. I mean, I tend to like this proposal, but I also want to make sure that there are, that we have it locked down in terms of this particular issue.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, I do want to make the legislative record. First, this language will be reviewed by the Attorney General's office right after this hearing. Mr. Rotenberg from the General Counsel of the University will make sure that that's done. Second, I want to make clear that nothing in this language indemnifies the University of Minnesota against claims from other than the state of Minnesota. Third, and I think that this is critical, this is only regarding the pollution or the pollutants that occurred prior to 1947. Anything that the university did to the land, this part of the bill has absolutely nothing to do with. There's no indemnification, release, or anything to do with anything the university did to the land during their ownership period.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that's a very important piece of legislative record to put out there right now, and so that members are aware of why the amendment is here and why folks are trying to work really hard on this before we get out to the House floor or it gets somehow muddled up in conference committee or something. I think it's good to do this work in a committee versus other places.
All right, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that very point, I think on line 412, I think that they should also review that as is conditioned. That implies to me that we're taking when it's all paid off, if no claims are made in the meantime about even current pollution, that we'll be accepting it as is, which I think that if you combine the amendment, which covers the pre-dates, and then the current events, I think that as is maybe opens it up to liability, so you can just discuss that. And I think it does. That's what as is. I sell properties as is. I rent properties as is. That means if the paint's ugly and if the roof leaks, then they got an ugly paint with a leaky roof. So I hope the discussion is thorough with the Attorney General.
Representative Aguinas. Representative Witness passes. Okay, members, I don't see any other people that wanted to discuss this issue. I have from counsel some recommended language that we had talked about. Here is the language. Page 1, line 3, a technical correction, insert a comma after the number 3. Page line 1, 6, a technical correction. There are two Minnesotas in that line, so it would be after the second Minnesota, insert Department of Natural Resources. And then page 1, line 14, after the period, insert, the university shall promptly endeavor to resolve its claims against the federal government with respect to environmental contamination that occurred prior to the time the university took title to the university land. Representative Abrams, is that satisfactory? And if so, could we incorporate that into your amendment?
That could be incorporated into the amendment, and I also want to make sure that that phrase in line 13 or adjacent to has also been deleted for purposes of revising the bill after it leaves this committee.
Yes, that has been done. Okay, any other discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the restated A-12 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A-12 amendment is adopted. Okay. Next, I'm going to go to Representative Holberg, who has an oral amendment. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday we talked about the purpose and findings section of the bill, section, and I'm just moving to delete that as being unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. So Representative Holberg offers an oral amendment to delete section 1. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose and findings are of limited utility. I'll let members deal with this as they wish. I just kind of view this as kind of nice comfort language, but that's about it.
Okay, any other discussion of the Holberg oral amendment? Okay, seeing no further discussion, we will vote on the Holberg oral amendment to delete section 1, the purpose and findings clause. All in favor of the Holberg oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, members, I have two other amendments that I know of before us, the DE1 amendment, which is the chair's, and the Vandeveer amendment. Are there the A14 amendment? I guess before I get to those, which I anticipate will require some discussion, are there any other amendments? All right. Members, then I will move the DE1 amendment. The chair moves the DE1 amendment. Members, this amendment basically returns the bill to the way it looked about a month or so ago. This is the originally introduced stadium plan. And I guess let me make a few incorporations into this just to reflect some things that have happened today. Number one, I would incorporate in the DE1 amendment that we strike the purpose and findings clause as was just done. Number two, I noticed that this is the language from last year when it was originally introduced. So on page 2, line 20, and on page 2, line 21, the $7 million should be $7.4 million. And on page 2, line 22, after the period, I would insert the language from the A15 amendment. In this case, the appropriation of up to $7.4 million per year may be made for no more than 25 years. Mm-hmm. Members, this amendment builds the exact same stadium that the bill before us builds. The stadium will look exactly the same. The stadium will be done at exactly the same time. There will not be a single brick different in the stadium under this amendment than underneath the old amendment. What this does have the effect of is it saves the state $2 million a year for 25 years, but then does not have us taking title to the university land, which has received a great deal of discussion. And members, when I first heard about this deal, I thought this was a pretty good deal. You know, I looked at the value of the land that I thought it would be worth based on what land is going for in the Twin Cities. You know, I thought, you know, if you could get a chunk of land like this in that area, this was a improvement to the bill. But then as I have read through the bill and as we looked at the testimony and had the discussion yesterday, we're not quite getting the land in the same way that people usually get land. You know, I have been a licensed real estate broker for 23 years. I've owned a real estate agency for 23 years. I have bought and sold and developed lots of land. But I've never seen a case where when you sell the land, the people who were the old owners of the land still can use the land just as they were using it before. And we had testimony yesterday that there would be no difference at all in what the university could use the land for if we were to buy the land as now. In other words, the university would be able to continue to use the land in every way they have been using it, for every purpose they've been using it, after we buy the land as opposed to before we buy the land. And in addition, if we ever chose to sell the land to someone else, the university would still retain the rights to do the same thing with the land, plant crops, do research, whatever, that they have right now. And I'm not against the university having the chance to do these things, but I guess I really am wondering what we are getting for $2 million. If you look on page 2, you will see on line 27, prohibited uses. The land can certainly never be sold off for residential, commercial, or industrial uses, so there's no opportunity to sell the land there. But beyond that, if we were to try to sell the land to someone else and the university wanted to put in crops on it and do a research plot of corn, you know, who would buy the land knowing the university always had rights to come in and do something with it, unless we had to go to the university and get their buy-off on it, which I suppose we could conceivably do, but then that's a whole different negotiation. Beyond that, we are in a situation where, while I think we will get along with the university, there are always disputes that may come up. And, you know, in addition to buying the land for $2 million, there are ongoing expenses to owning the land. There's insurance, there's property management, there's maintenance, there are other costs to owning the land. You know, I'm not so sure that we shouldn't be paid to take the land underneath these circumstances as opposed to actually paying to buy the land. And I appreciate what Representative McNamara and Osmond and others are trying to do in taking a piece of environmentally sensitive land and letting it come to the state for development, but I see no reason that we could not structure a deal with the university outside of this bill and arrange for some state access to the land, and even arrange for the state to build buildings on the land if we saw that to be a good idea. And so, members, I offer this with the idea of saying, if we're concerned about buying the land and having access to the land, we can certainly work that outside this deal. I know some people are concerned about environmental contamination on the land. I'm not sure if that's really that big of an issue, but some are. To the extent they are, this eliminates that concern. Members, this DE1 amendment builds the exact same stadium for $2 million a year less. And so I would offer the DE1 amendment. Representative Abrams.
A couple points, Mr. Chairman. I think that line 21 of the amendment, the 94, should be 99, according to Dick Pitsenreiter. Page 2, line 2.21 of the amendment.
All right. I'll incorporate that, Representative Abrams. Page 2, line 21. We took the language from last year, and there have been some updated cost figures this year, and I had gotten the $7 million ones, but not the 94. So the $94 million should be $99 million.
Second, I would like to speak a moment about the current uses of the land, and I got more information last night that I think that members of the committee would find important. Currently, the university is conducting research on approximately 200 acres of the 2,840 acres of land. And their other use, other university use, is 40 acres that they use for longitudinal studies and to grow various crops in order to feed some livestock animals at the St. Paul campus. So basically, outside of those uses, the university really isn't utilizing the land. A good chunk of the land, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 acres, are currently being used as farmland on short-term leases. And what the vision of the university is that this is underutilized land now. The land can be restored to Prairie State, et cetera, and allow more access. If you go to the land, Representative McNamara and Representative Osment are far more knowledgeable about the land than I do. Yes, there is a trail, and there is a horse trail there, but they're not really being utilized. It really isn't an access point. And as a matter of fact, if you go around the land, I am told that there are big no trespassing signs all over the place. So I wouldn't exactly... this land is not a bustling hub of activity and is not being really utilized to any large extent today. So I appreciate that what the public policy question is the access and other uses that can be made of this land worth the additional $2 million per year. I happen to think yes. I think it's better than the first proposal. I was very comfortable with the first proposal, but I think the proposal that's before you today is a better proposal.
All right. I have a number of people. Let me start with Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to touch on a couple of the points, and Representative Abrams has talked about the land use. I'd like to simplify the proposal. The original proposal was the $99 million. And I'll just call this, for simplification purposes, it's another $25 million of state money. And I'm talking present value. I know if you talk over the years, it's different values. But I'll just use those numbers. So what is the state doing for the additional $25 million that the University of Minnesota would get? It allows the regents to cut the student fee in half. The student fee under the proposal generates, I believe, in the neighborhood of $50 million. This would reduce it to $25 million. So on the surface, members, if you looked at it and said, oh, so we give them $25 million and the students save $25 million, you could almost say, well, that seems pretty even at that. Well, in addition to that, we take land that the university has had since 1947, basically looks the same way it did when I was a kid, 8 years old, sneaking on the land. It's the same way it looked. They've really not done anything other than they still have the no trespassing signs all around it, and you can't go near it. This would get the land for the DNR's management
where it would be available for all the public to use as a wildlife management area. That would include students coming from the downtown areas of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and I would let Representative Osman say how long it takes him to commute, because he lives right on the edge of this area. But my estimation on my commute time in this morning was it was about 25 minutes into the Capitol. So it just allows that use, the students to be able to use that land and access it and have a real outdoor experience. The land has been valued in the range of $40 million to $100 million. I often have just said the land is priceless. But even if you put a range on there, and even if you want to take the conservative land values and say $40 million, you still add that deal. We're only paying $25. That's a win-win, even if you don't count the students. I think when you add it all together, and I understand we do need to reconcile the pollution, because I don't think it's fair that we take on some liability of pollution that we don't deserve. But I just think it's a win-win-win for everybody in the state.
Members, there's one other technical amendment I found, and that's, or I've been alerted to, rather, on page 2, line 15. The $141 million should be $149 million. That, again, is an update from last year. Next, I've got Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, some of what I was going to point out was already commented on, but... You know, I've been kind of searching as to what the advantage of this most recent plan is to the taxpayers, since they're both public entities that own them. I've supported this, or supported a stadium from the beginning. I think it passed out of the Higher Ed Finance Committee unanimously under the original plan. This is a new scenario, but the one thing that attracted me to the new scenario was the fact that student fees were reduced from the $53 million to roughly $26 or half that at $25 per quarter. Now, your amendment shifts then 20-some million back on to the students through the student fees. So what I would like to do is offer an amendment to the amendment, and that we just do this totally up front, and that on line 20, page 2, that we strike $7.4 million and put in $9.4 million, and do the same thing on line 21, strike the $94 million and put in $124 million, and strike the $7 million and put in $9.4 million. And what we do with this amendment, Mr. Chairman, is still give some advantage under what I'll call Plan 2 debt to the students. Now, I do recognize that the students, when we had a discussion in higher education, did endorse that $50 per semester fee, but I found that rather interesting, quite frankly, being that it was present-day students and that the fee really wasn't to be imposed until the stadium was complete. So that was kind of an easy vote for students today, because they were shifting it on to another generation of students. But I think, Mr. Chairman, if the amendment I've just offered were to go on, then we would be giving some relief to the students and dealing with the real financing up front. It wouldn't do any violence to the construction of the stadium, which I say I support, but would like to provide some relief to students.
Okay, so let me restate. The Carlson oral amendment is on page 2, line 20 of the amendment, and page 2, line 21 of the amendment. Change the now $7.4 million to $9.4 million. And Representative Carlson, I guess
Chairman,
I...
Chairman, we also have to change that 94 to 124.
And also on page 2, line 21, change the $94 million to $99 million. And I... $124
million.
Change what is the $99 million now to $124 million. I don't know. I wonder, Representative Carlson, do we need to change page 2, line 15 to something, too?
124.
Yeah, page 2, line 15 would be changed to $124 million. So, members, essentially what Representative Carlson's amendment does is have us not buy the land, have us still pay the same amount of money as proposed underneath the original, or underneath the Abrams bill as it came to the committee. And members will take discussion to the Carlson Amendment. I guess I would oppose the Carlson Amendment. First, there is nothing here that says that that money necessarily goes toward the students and reducing their tuition. I think the assumption is that it will, but there's nothing that says that it does. In any case, members, in this whole discussion, it's the university that's making the decision on how much money they raise or don't raise student tuition. That's not us as a state. If they get more money in private fundraising than they expected, the student fees may be less. If they have fewer collections than expected, I imagine it's possible student fees may be more. And so, members, that is not really, in my sense, any part of this particular bill as it's written, although there are assumptions that the university has brought forward to us on how they expect to get their half or their percentage of the money. With that, other discussion to the Carlson oral amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
I was hoping that you would be acceptant of the amendments so that we could provide some relief to the students. I've had conversations, especially with graduate students, about their concern about the $53 million and was trying to create a win-win situation for students in this whole situation, so I'll withdraw the amendment.
Well, thank you for your consideration, Representative Carlson. Carlson withdraws the amendment. Okay, members, we're back to discussion to the DE1 amendment. I've got Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, I think there is value to be had in transferring the land. However, this transfer is not tight enough for me, and we've certainly worked on getting it tighter with language that we have changed. But what is not in here is a management plan for the land, so it really is a public asset for people to go in and use. It is not inexpensive to manage this land, and I think Representative Abler brought up the point that we are receiving it as is, and the condition I'd like to see it in is a condition of with native species restored, stream banks taken care of, and the kinds of canopies we need to keep the trout streams usable. It seems to me we have to incorporate in here a tighter management plan, and I know the university is responsible, but the university is responsible and we're getting the land as in an as-is condition. So would you be willing to work on that kind of tightening of a management plan for this site?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to draw many members' attention to line 3.31 of the bill that's before you. In furtherance of this subdivision, the university and DNR shall promptly endeavor to enter into a joint powers agreement or conservation easement, which agreement or easement shall provide for cooperative oversight of the university land. And then it goes into current leases, et cetera. The current leases, I understand, are very short-term leases. If that language needs, additional tightening or clarification, Representative Wagenius, I'd certainly be open, and I know the university would be open to talk. And if you need a report next year on the plan, Representative Wagenius, that's probably the best way to go. But if you need comfort language on that, I'd be very happy to work with you to put that in.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Cooperative oversight is we can all sit there and look at it. I'm looking for outcomes. I mean, the governor has taught us again and again to ask for outcomes. And so it's more than cooperative oversight.
and we need to have specific outcomes. And I think you don't need much more than several more phrases added to this language to make sure that we get the kind of outcomes that I think you intend,
mm-hmm.
and I think the university intends. But if I'm going to my constituents and saying, this is what we did, and this is what you get, I want to make sure they get what I'm telling them they're getting.
Okay. We'll certainly work on that before the forward ceremony begins.
Thank you.
Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and we're talking about this land and the management of it. Is the DNR planning to do this for free, or...? There's nothing on the fiscal note that I'm looking at related to the amendment or to the bill.
Representative Vandeveer, actually, I don't believe we have a fiscal note on this. We have, I think, a revenue estimate technically. But I see Commissioner Holston here. Commissioner, perhaps you can enlighten us.
Thank you,
do things for free, Commissioner Holston.
Chair, members, my name is Mark Olson, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. It's about priorities, and if this becomes a priority piece, this is a priority piece that the department feels would be a great asset to the state of Minnesota to provide recreational opportunities in the metropolitan area. We would manage it as best we could. Is there going to be a cost associated with it? Absolutely. Would we be using a variety of different avenues and techniques to get that done? Absolutely. We have a large number of partners out there who are very, very interested in providing resources to this particular project. So those costs would be greatly offset. But I guess I don't know what else to say.
Representative Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner Holston, I'm just impressed by your willingness to take on this new project. And could you maybe tell me what you wouldn't be doing then if it's a matter of priorities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, no, at this point I can't tell you what we would not be doing at this point to do this. With the existing revenues that we have.
Okay, members, I have Representatives Sikora, Dorman, Hamilton, and Wagenius. Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, pardon me, Deputy Commissioner Holston. last year, when we did the budget bill, because you were short of money, for the first time we had to take some millions of dollars from the school trust lands because you guys could no longer manage the school trust lands without taking money out of the fund that's supposed to go to children for education. And so I'm wondering, you know, if this is not going to cost anymore, why was it that all of a sudden we had to put a bunch of money out there for the school trust land management? I'm sorry, but, you know, we can use any dollar we can get for education, and I'm kind of confused by this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sikora, I didn't say it wasn't going to cost anything. There is a cost to management. To be able to come in and tell you what that cost dollar would be, I can't do at this point. To try to equate forest school trust fund land management and wildlife management land management as equal, they are two entirely different management schemes, and the funding sources are completely different. The funding sources that we use for wildlife management lands come from the Game and Fish Fund. It is borne by the sportsmen and women of the state who buy hunting and fishing licenses. The school trust fund lands that are managed by the Department for Forestry and Mining are managed through the general fund. Now, what we were dealing with there is a shift in trying to capture some of those revenues before they were deposited into the account to offset those costs that we use for management on those lands. So it's not an apples-to-apples comparison when you start getting into the details of the budget. of the Department of Natural Resources and how it manages those different lands. Different revenue sources manage different lands.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sephora.
One word or two? Commissioner Holston, this is about priorities. Now, is there enough money in your game and fish fund for management of this land also then, this new land that we're taking on that you said would be managed differently, the wildlife areas, than like the school trust lands are? Because to me, the school trust lands would be a pretty high priority. Mm-hmm. So is there enough money so it won't cost more to manage these new lands?
Mr. Holston.
That was confusing, wasn't it? It seems to me in your priorities, the school trust lands aren't ranking very high. What I'm asking you is, do you need more personnel, more FTEs, more everything to manage this new land we're taking on? Because we have not considered that as we look at this bill today.
Mr. Holston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sikora. We would be entering into, again, with the university, a management plan to determine how fast the rate and of the operational expenses to going into these lands. It would be borne, again, by the Division of Fish and Wildlife that is funded through the Game and Fish Fund. And those are going to be budget decisions that not this legislature, but future legislatures are going to have to prioritize those dollars that are dedicated to those activities. Again, getting back to the school trust fund lands and forestry and mineral management are an entirely different component and different funding cycle, different funding streams and management. It'd be like asking us to compare our funding source to MnDOT and roads and bridges. I know because we're the Department of Natural Resources, everything's fungible. It's not. There are dedicated accounts. There are specific accounts. There's different. There's firewalls between these activities.
Thank you.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, I don't know if you can answer this question or someone from the university can, but I'm once again confused, and this is on the area of student fees.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I understood that the proposal was that students would pay $100 a year in student fees, the original proposal, and with your changes from President McNamara and Osmond, that would be cut down to $50. So I thought what I understand the effect of the Knobloch amendment would be to double those student fees. And yet I think I heard Representative Knobloch say that, well, that's not really right. And so I'm just kind of curious, what's the fee situation here for the students?
Let me give a short answer, and Mr. Fitzenreiter can give another one, or a longer answer. Under the current financing proposal for the university, there are a number of non-state sources. One of the non-state sources is student fees. The Board of Regents has said that if this proposal went forward, the student fee would be $25 a semester or $50 a year for students in order to fund the portion of the non-state funding. If the Knobloch amendment passed under the original proposal, the university had stated its intent to have a $50 a semester fee or $100 per year fee. That's the stated intention of the Board of Regents, and that's the proposals that have gone for 2 years in a row, I believe, to the Student Association. And the Student Association has agreed with both. I would suspect that if the Knobloch amendment passed, that the board would probably go back to the original $50-$100 construct, but I think that before they did that, they would probably have another conversation with the students, because they just had a conversation with them with the new levels.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Yes, Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll give a short answer. In the interest of full disclosure, if Chairman Knobloch's correct, the legislature does not set that fee number and is not set in the bill, but I think it's important for members of the committee to understand that going back to the original proposal, while the president has always made it clear that our priority is to raise as much money as we can and benefit the students by lowering the fee, and it's why we took the extra $2 million and did that, if the Knobloch Amendment did pass, I think it's important for people to understand that we would, in our judgment, be back at the $50 per semester on students.
Representative Dorman.
So if we adopt this, it looks like we'll be doubling the student fee on this. What happens in summer school? When I went to university, in order to get out of there in 6 years for a four-year degree, I had to go to a couple summer schools. What happens there? You got just you talk about it as 50 or under the Knobloch deal, $100 a year or a semester. What happens? You still got summer school over there?
Mr. Pitsenrider.
Mr. Chairman, we did predicate this on the two semesters, not the summer activity. The revenue estimates don't apply to them.
Mr. Pitsenrider, you don't happen to have Representative Dorman's academic records with you, do you?
They've been lost.
Well, members, I guess I just interject and make a point.
There's a fire, Mr. Chairman.
Members, I just interject to make the point that there is nothing in either the DE-1 amendment or the original bill that actually specifically says anything whatsoever about student fees. Clearly, the university has a plan, and they've expressed it to us, but there is nothing in any of the legislation that actually talks about fees. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to point out that the University of Minnesota is a land-grant university and has a commitment to agriculture. And one of the statements that the opening statements, Mr. Chairman, the statement about having corn there versus buildings, I personally am pleased that there's corn there versus buildings. In subpart 9 on prohibited uses, my question is this, and maybe yourself or Chair Muscoplat or others could comment on this. In the event we do have this prohibited uses, what is the guarantee for the university's commitment of agriculture, and would that land still be used for test plots or agricultural purposes?
I think we should have Mr. Muscoplat come forward, but I certainly wasn't suggesting that it was a bad thing for the university to have corn test plots, Representative Hamilton. Mr. Muscoplat.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Hamilton, thank you for the opportunity to speak to agriculture. It's something I do on a regular basis. But I would say that of all the land we do use for agriculture at Umore Park, nearly all the agricultural research is north of 170th Street. Well, we do maybe 2,000 acres of agricultural activities, about 600 is research. For the land south of 170th, there's about 200 acres of agricultural research and some hundreds of acres of other agricultural uses, largely rental activities. And we have more than enough land to do agricultural research of all types on the land that remaining north of 170th. I would also say that the most types of research that I could imagine over the next 100 years would be low impact, and they would be compatible with virtually anything I could imagine being done in a sense of a nature preserve or environmental sensitive park in conjunction with the Dakota County Regional Park and lands to the east and to the south.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, I think I feel some confusion with regard to the management of the land for recreational or environmental purposes. Yesterday we heard testimony that the U was going to be the manager and pay the costs, and so when we had the line of question of DNR, I was confused. I think it is still the U that will pay the costs, but work with DNR, in which case DNR would not be paying the management costs, it would just be paying the oversight costs. Have I got that right, Representative Abrams?
Mr. Pitsenrider.
Mr. Chairman, members, the university for the period of the 25 years is responsible for the normal day-to-day maintenance, you know, plow the roads, fix a fence, whatever. If there are improvements in infrastructure, you know, a park trail, a parking lot, for access, for a wildlife management area, that is the responsibility of the Department of Natural Resources. And the exact, you know, how to parse this is part of coming up with that agreement that's in the legislation, because you can't anticipate every circumstance in legislation.
Okay, I have Representative McNamara, Cranky, Osment, and Beard. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Deputy Commissioner Holston could come back. My question, Deputy Commissioner, deals with the restoration work and your experience. The other areas that I've been involved in, restoration, the native prairie, and restoration for wildlife management area. The one I was just aware of was a 640-acre parcel where the restoration and the maintenance for the next couple of years was going to be about $410 an acre, and this land maybe has a little more complicated site, might be a little more than that. When I put that out, if so 1,000 acres of restoration is $400,000 or a couple thousand to $800,000, I think of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that the sportsman group raised in the Twin Cities area and have sent that money to southwestern Minnesota or other areas. My talk with the interest groups was they really look forward to the opportunity to raise millions of dollars for the restoration work and the maintenance of this kind of a site so close to them. What is your thoughts along those lines? I see this as a potential the DNR could really restore this at the interest groups backing.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Holston.
Mr. Chair, members, what this is significant of a, I would say an acquisition, but a opportunity within the metropolitan area, unlike anything that we have seen or are probably will see, to provide something of this mass and this quality of natural resource recreational opportunities to the citizens for wildlife management purposes. We have our partners being Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, the TNCs of the Nature Conservancies of the world. Those conservation groups are chapter-based local organizations, and they generate tremendous amount of volunteer and financial resources for restoration type of we would speculate, and from the conversations that we've had with the leadership of some of these organizations, that they would use this as an opportunity to use those local chapters in the metropolitan area who would like to see some money spent in their local communities or within the metropolitan area but are currently not. And so we would speculate that many of the restoration costs would be assisted or accelerated to get this facility into a the status that we would, as the citizens of the state, like to see it in. It would be driven in large part by those organizations.
Representative McNamara, at this point,
yeah. And just real quick, so then Deputy Commissioner Holston, if any of the groups like Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Turkey Federation, Minnesota Deer Hunters, Rough Grouse Society, all these groups that are active in the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota, expressed any disappointment of the possible acquisition of this land?
Representative, or Commissioner Holston.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, of the organizations I've spoken to, they are very excited about this, and I have not heard any disheartened about this.
Representative Osment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to thank the University of Minnesota for being willing to listen to the proposition or the proposal many of us who have are from that area, and this particular property we're talking about is no longer in my legislative district, but it was in my district for years before redistricting, and it's within just a few miles of my home. And so I'm very well acquainted with the property. And it is, members, a rolling wooded hills with a natural sandstone structures on some of the hills. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful site. It's a real treasure. But, members, if you need to remember that the University of Minnesota's mission is educational. They're not in the open space land management business. And if the state of Minnesota turns down this opportunity, I'm afraid that that property becomes a liability to the University of Minnesota. Because why should they continue to spend money to manage open spaces when that's not their primary mission? And the land is extremely valuable. Land very near this property that has open farmland has been purchased because of the gravel deposits out there, which are also very likely on this property, that it has sold for $36,000 an acre just 2 years ago. So this is a very valuable land and growing. When you talk about residential development, rolling wooded hills, you're talking about estates that would be developed out there in short order, and the university could make far more money than what we're talking about here. I think it's because they have a deep moral conviction, a social conviction that that really should remain an open space out there, that they have not taken the advantage of selling or putting that property on the market. But they are currently in the evaluation or study of what to do with the entire acreage out there. And if the state of Minnesota is going to say, no, even though your education is your primary mission, we want you to become land managers, I think they're going to have to say where they're going to draw the line and when they're going to turn that asset into cash. And I think that that's the real risk that we're running here if we would turn this down. I think that the 936 acres of agricultural land that's currently in this, out of that 2,840 acres, is something that I know that we can see how that can be managed and we can work in. But I know that those farmers will not be able to continue there at all should that turn into a residential development or if it's stripped out to become a rock quarry. And that's, to me, this is a real opportunity. If you look at the price that we're talking about, Minnesotans that have this type of a wildlife management area within the metropolitan area, the deputy commissioner stated it clearly, this is a treasure that you cannot replace. This is something that's actually priceless in its scope. And I really hope that you will continue to keep this proposal in the bill and reject the Knobloch Amendment, because I think that the Knobloch Amendment would not be in the best interest of the state of Minnesota or the wildlife opportunities in the metropolitan area.
We have Representative Beard and Klinzing. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be for someone from the university, because I'm going to ask for a brief history of the land and how it was conveyed to the university. I'm sorry we couldn't be here for the presentation last night, but several of us were locked up in regulated industries all afternoon. So I'm glad to be back here. But I'm asking two things: how it was conveyed to the university, and what restrictions are on that might be on the deed to the property that would somehow meddle with the ability of the university to convey the property. While someone's coming, just an additional comment: I'm aware that in the city of South St. Paul, for instance, after the war, Second World War, the Defense Department conveyed a large parcel to the city of South St. Paul for use as an airport. And the city here controls it, owns it, operates it as long as it's an airport. But as soon as the city gets out of the airport business, the property reverts to the Department of Defense for their purposes. So the city is free to enjoy it for public purposes, but is restricted in what they can do with it if they ever want to dispose of it. And I'm looking for that kind of discussion about this piece of property.
Mr. Muscoplatt.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Beard, representatives. This land was acquired by the federal government, I believe, in 1942 for the purpose of munitions production, smokeless gunpowder. The plant went online in 1945. At that peak moment in the spring of 1945, there were 12,000 employees in 800 buildings. The plant operated until August of 1945 when the war ended. It shut down. In 1947, the federal government gifted the land to the University of Minnesota with a stipulation that it be used for 30 years for a public purpose. That stipulation and that requirement for the public use has lapsed, and the university is free to use it for the purposes that the university uses it for, determined by the Board of Regents, for teaching, research, and outreach. And I believe it's fairly simple. There are some details about several sub-parcels of land given at different times, but that's the, I think, that most important summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment.
Representative Beard.
So it appears then that the university is free to use the property or dispose of it as they see fit, including some sort of a partnership with the state through the DNR. Or if the DE1 amendment is applied, they can continue to use it for their own purposes or dispose of it to the advantage of the university then, correct?
Mr. Westblatt.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Beard, yes, that's correct.
Representative Klinzing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak after we vote on the amendment.
I'm sorry, what's that, Representative Klinzing?
I'd like to speak after we vote on this amendment.
Oh, all right. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think this is an important amendment, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call is requested. Representative Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is probably the most important discussion that we'll have as it relates to this bill. At least for me, I haven't heard this. I think I'm one of the co-authors because I support the concept. But quite frankly, the biggest concern that I've had is over student fees. And as an alumni of the University of Minnesota, it may not, the $25 difference may not seem like a lot, but when I was at the U, that would have been a lot. And so, members, I would hope that that we don't choose to increase student fees and that we vote appropriately or vote in accordance with that on this amendment.
Representative Cranky, let me go back to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I had a question regarding, since it's been a while since I've been to a University of Minnesota football game, somebody give me some idea what the ticket prices are?
Hi there. Welcome back to the committee. Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
My name is Liz Ewell. I'm the Senior Associate Athletic Director and Chief Financial Officer for Gopher Athletics. Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, our ticket prices have been set for next year. Our public season ticket price is $225. Our student ticket price is $10 a game and six games, so you've got $60 for our students.
And I'm sorry, if I walk up and, or let's say, what if I just went over and wanted to buy a ticket, one ticket? What do I pay as a just a member of the public?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, we do have a varying scale with regard to our single game tickets. Our non-conference tickets are priced at $25 for next year, and our Big Ten games are priced at
$45 to $55. Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, talking about student fees, it seems to me that number one, what the university wants to do here is it wants to charge all of the students in their fees to pay for this football stadium. Yet the, maybe I'm wrong here. We're going to increase. Is there a plan to increase the cost of student tickets when you have a new stadium?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, our expectation is that all our ticket prices in our pro forma that we did in the financing of the stadium would increase at a rate of 3% a year.
Representative Krinke.
So, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I just say, why don't they just increase the cost of a ticket? They're going to have this brand new stadium, and I don't know. I kind of, you know, we're big on fees around here. I mean, why don't they just? I think that's kind of a user fee. You want to go to the football game? You pay to support the University of Minnesota football. You pay to support the cost of the new stadium. So, you can go to a game as a student for $10. I don't know why we're so worried about the student fees. Let the University of Minnesota let the students figure this out. The students don't want to pay the fee. Let them jack up the cost of the ticket to go to the game. So, I like the chairman's proposal. Let's go back to just $7.4 million a year and let the University of Minnesota, with their cost of the ticket to go to the game, pay for the increased cost of building the facility.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Representative Krenke, your great-grandfather, who went to the University of Minnesota before there was a forward pass, some would question if he wore a helmet or not. When he was a student, he paid a student fee for a Memorial Stadium. So the idea of students making some contribution for athletic facilities at the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota certainly is not a new one, but the assistant AD certainly can add to that.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Krenke.
Now that Representative Abrams brought this up, what happened to Memorial Stadium anyway, Representative Abrams?
Oh, I promised myself I wasn't going to say this, Representative Krenke, but the former Board of Regents unanimously, at the urging of Sid Hartman and Harvey McKay, moved, and Lou Holtz, Lulu of Old Notre Dame, moved Gopher football from Memorial Stadium to the Metrodome. There was controversy at the time, Representative Krenke, because the legislature was either unwilling or unable to make some capital improvements to Memorial Stadium for health and safety reasons. The university was unwilling to do so out of existing university resources. And I think that part of the story kind of gets forgotten. But, yes, Representative Krenke, if the question is why did they move, with the Board of Regents move, the elites in Minneapolis in particular said they would move, but there was also a problem at the university as to the health, safety, and other factors dealing with a stadium that at the time was over 60 years old.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I'm curious about Representative Krenke's comments, but I just want to make sure I heard him right. I thought he said he supported your plan, but I'm not sure why he would, given his comments that it should just be paid for by the students, because doesn't this require, Chairman Knobloch, doesn't your amendment require still $7 million a year from the state? So, or did you take that state money out of there? I'm trying to figure out.
$7.4 million per year, to be precise, Representative Dorman.
So even under your plan, there's still state money and things of that nature going into this stadium.
Yes, there is, Representative Dorman, $2 million a year less than underneath the current proposal.
I was confused after I heard Representative Krenke speak, but thank you. There's now light where there was formerly dark.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond briefly to Representative Dorman, I said I preferred the chairman's approach to the bill that is currently in front of us. I didn't say I supported the bill, no matter which way it comes out.
Representative Riccobina.
Mr. Chair, I've been listening here, and before I can make a decision on this amendment, I was wondering if someone from the university could inform me how many students and parents of students live in the 6 congressional districts in the state of Minnesota. Can we get that? Well,
we can get you the list, Representative.
Okay, I guess I'm informed.
Chair Knobloch,
President,
as I listen to the conversation, I intend to go back to my office and grow the numbers this afternoon.
Members, as I look at this, you know, when I think about the amendment I brought forward, the other way I could go about this is to look at page 3. Because if I look at page 3, line 24, I, you know, bring everyone's attention to the language that says, the obligation of the state of Minnesota to make the payments required under Section 4 herein is... I'm talking about the original, yes. I'm talking about the original bill. Page 3, line 24, it says, the obligation of the state of Minnesota to make the payments required under Section 4 herein is expressly conditioned upon the university's covenant in perpetuity, subject to Division 3 limiting the use of university land to the permitted university uses and the other permitted uses, and prescribing the use of the university land for any of the prohibited uses. So remember, when we get back to how valuable this land is, I think this land is very valuable, but not necessarily all that valuable to the state or any other owner with that language in. And again, I would refer you to page 4, line 13 of the bill as it now stands. Says, upon the agreement of the university and the state, all or part of the university land may be transferred to another governmental unit of the state. So we need the university's agreement to transfer land to another governmental unit of the state. Again, on line 15, any conveyance shall be subject to the perpetual right of the university to use the university land for the permitted university uses and to the rights of third parties under presently existing lease agreements, etc. So, and then it goes on to talk about the instruments of transfer shall otherwise limit the use of the university land to other permitted uses and subject uses to such restrictions as may be provided in any agreement, etc. So again, members, you know, this is very valuable land if you're getting free and clear of encumbrances. But there are a lot of encumbrances to this land. I really question how much we are really buying for this land. You know, maybe what I should do is change my amendment to strike this language and have us buy the land for $9.4 million without all these restrictions. Maybe that's the way that I should go about trying to approach this, because that would be another way to approach the subject, and then that would take care of people's concerns about the student tuition. But Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for a little guidance on your plan here. I think we have members that are starting to run into other committee times, and I just would like to know how long you plan to go right now, and when we might, if we break, when we might reconvene. I've been asked by a number of members to clarify what our schedule is here.
Okay, sure. Well, I think we're coming up to a resolution on this amendment pretty quickly here. I have one other person that wants to speak to it. We have one other amendment, the Vandeveer amendment. I want to get this bill resolved one way or another by 11 o'clock so that we can have it on second reading for today at 3 o'clock. You know, depending on how we go, we may recess, give people a lunch break, come back at noon to do the targets. That's kind of where I'm thinking at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that roadmap.
You bet. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief and concise in my remarks. First of all, this member is going to say unequivocally I support the state's role in building a Gopher Stadium on the campus. The past being what it is what it is. We're going to build a stadium. And when I first heard about the land transfer in exchange for that, I thought, oh, what an innovative approach. But I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. As I'm looking at it, what we're buying here is a pig in a poke. This is not anything that's necessary to make a stadium deal happen. The point of perpetuity that you just raised is one I don't want to get too far down the road because I'll plow deep and be here for a long time. But perpetuity is a really long time. I think it means forever. And there is property on there that's not really necessarily parkland, but actually is productive land that could go to other productive private uses. If we control this via the deal that's in front of us in House File 263, that land's never going to be productive land contributing to the tax base. If we let the university control it, and that was the gist of my questions about how they own this, there is a good chance that if the DE1 amendment is purchased, the university can still do a deal with the state and create a park. And there is an outside chance that some of that land can still go back to private hands eventually. I kind of like that scenario better than locking this whole thing up to the 263 original file. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to encourage my colleagues in the committee to support the DE1 amendment, and let's address a park issue in a separate time, a separate way.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I take exception to your view that there's a large number of restrictions on his property. What we're talking about is the property being managed in a consistent with wildlife management areas, and that the activity that's ongoing out there at the university currently has is a little over 200 acres of agricultural research that's going on. And it's really basically, that's my understanding, is going to be their concern long term. And if we could have the university speak to that specific point, is what type of restrictions or access do you visualize going to be in this agreement that will be written up with the Department of Natural Resources?
Mr. Musselplatt.
Is it really the huge number of obligations that the chair alludes to?
Chair Knobloch, Representative Osment, thank you for the question. As you and I and Representative McNamara have spoken over the last several weeks, we think this is a reasonable proposal. Reasonable people will find it easy to agree. The types of research that we would do, I don't think would impact what would be a state park or nature preserve. We do some amount of agricultural research, as Representative Hamilton questioned, about 200 acres in the northwest part. And you yourself mentioned there's some agricultural rental land in the southern region. But that leaves a large body of land that is likely to be left for environmental preserve, parks, recreation, wildlife management. The types of research that we would have perpetual rights to would be environmental research, things that we do there now, earth-atmospheric interaction, studying the native species, studying the water runoff. As Representative Wagenius mentioned yesterday and today, we do things such as bank research and stream erosion research. Although we don't do it on that river, we do it in other parts of the state. In my opinion, Representative Osment, they're not intrusive at all. We can actually improve the value of the property as an amenity by making the subject of our research. We can improve the prairie restoration. We can improve the tree stands. We can improve the environmental quality through remediation. We can study the trout and the trout streams with our fisheries and wildlife. And I think that you would imagine, as Representative Osment and I have talked, 100 years from now, when the population has greatly surrounded this region and grown beyond it, we have set aside 2,800 acres of land that people will be thankful for years to come, much as you see Central Park in New York City. The land, if it's not priceless today, becomes priceless in the future, and is really a modest price for preserving this for perpetuity.
Okay. Members, as I think about the other scenario I had of maybe introducing some language to maybe have to have the land quite so tied up, because Representative Osment, I guess if I look at page 2, line 27 of the original bill, for starters, the land can never be used for residential, commercial, or industrial use. I mean, that is a pretty big restriction to begin with. Beyond that, the university has rights in perpetuity to use the land for whatever they're using it for now. There are some pretty big restrictions on this land. So, members, I guess I would respond to Representative Osment with that comment. And members, in the interest of moving things along, I'm going to consider bringing this amendment or a different amendment along the lines of what I just talked about to the floor, but I'm going to withdraw this amendment. Representative Clinzy.
I'm so disappointed.
Mr. Chair, with that amendment withdrawn,
okay.
I'd just like to state I have a lot of concerns about the environmental impact of this bill. We have spent over 4 hours putting ourselves in the position of acting like the Environment Committee, and even two legislative members in this body who are on that committee have talked about how important this is as an environmental treasure, how important this land is as an environmental treasure, how priceless it is. And we've also had a lot of testimony to the amount of pollution on both these pieces of land, and there's a lot of uneasiness about who's going to be responsible for cleaning it up, how much it's going to cost, whether this is included in the stadium price. And there's a mixed message on whether the DNR can actually afford to manage these lands. I'd like to move to re-refer this back to the Environment Committee. I'm very surprised that this hasn't gone there at all, and that it just skipped and bypassed that product, because if this land really is priceless as an environmental treasure, then we should have a very careful management plan spelled out. All these questions should be answered, and they should be done in the Environment Committee, not in the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Okay, Representative Klinzing moves that the bill be referred to the Environment Finance Committee. Discussion, Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, when the plan first came forward, Representative Klinzing, one of my first people who I sought out was the chair of the Environment Committee, who told me that he would prefer the bill to go to the Ways and Means Committee and that he did not want to hear the bill. So it wasn't at least this bill author who said we're going to not go to the Environment Committee. I made the offer, Representative Klinzing, and just followed the advice I was given.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to speak to that issue, I think we have in this committee, so I'm the lead on the Environment Committee that it would have gone to, I believe, and because it would have gone to Environment Finance. We have, I think, very close to resolving all of the environmental, the issues that the Environmental Committee would have considered and clearly come down on the side, as long as we get our cross our T's and dot our I's, clearly come down on the side of having the state take this land, because our hunting and fishing groups in this state are desperate for additional lands. And I don't think I overuse the word desperate. So if we think about them, I think we will reject the Klinzing amendment.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Klinzing, I'm going to oppose your motion. I think that because we have tied this to statute, which is the Wildlife Management Area Statute, which sends out a very clear plan for how the land will be managed, I do not think that this is needing a stop in environment or environment finance. I think the other issue here is the one that Representative Wagenius just spoke to, which in terms of how we're working through the issue of making sure the public is protected in terms of being able to seek redress from any contamination issues, we are nearly to completion with some review by the Attorney General's office. So I would see this as an unnecessary step.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Klinzing.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I hope that I really think that not sending it to the Environment Committee and just bypassing that really shows a lack of integrity to our process and having committees review things carefully. And we will, I'm sure, hear from both sides of the aisle as we move forward on numbers of others of bills that just bypass committees conveniently. And we are supposed to sit here in Ways and Means and look at kind of the overall budget picture. And I don't know if all the members of the Environment Committee would be pleased to know that we also, according to Representative Wagenius, I guess, are good enough as a stamp of approval for the Environment Committee. And I respect Representative Osmond's chairmanship to make that decision, but as the integrity of the particular of the process of sending these things to be carefully reviewed by those committees that review these things all the time, I really would like to continue to urge your support of this referral.
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to correct the record. It was Representative Hackbarth that has the policy committee. I believe that Representative Abrams talked to.
I think I talked to both of you, Representative Osmond.
But it would have first went to the policy committee, and that's Representative Hackbarth is the one that said it was not necessary.
Representative Silberger.
Let's have a roll call on this, please.
A roll call vote is requested. Any other discussion on the Klinzing motion to amend the Abrams motion that the bill be referred to the Committee on Environment Finance? Okay, clerk, we'll call the roll.
Dempsey?
No.
Abler?
Yeah.
Abrams?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Aye.
Bradley?
No.
Biskins?
No.
Carlson?
No.
Clark?
No.
Thurman?
No.
Thorne?
No.
Earhart?
No.
Reiling?
Gunther? Hamilton?
No.
Hilty? Hobart?
Yes.
Huntley?
No.
Kelleher?
No.
Frinzing?
Yes.
Frankie?
Yes.
Larson?
No.
Mariani?
Is that a, I think that was a no. A weak no. Quiet no.
McNamara?
No.
Nernis?
No.
Otramba?
No.
Asmet?
No.
Hamer?
Aye.
Rukavina?
No.
Ruth?
No.
Seifert? Smith?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Sakura?
No.
Vandeveer?
Yes.
McGinnis?
No.
Walker?
No.
Knobloch?
Yes. There have been 8 ayes and 26 nays. The motion does not prevail. Representative Vandeveer has an amendment. Representative Vandeveer, you wish to move the A14 amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. It's a simple amendment. It's pretty straightforward. It just directs the university, if the university does, it uses embryonic stem cells in other than those from lines approved for federal funding by the National Institute of Health. It would stop the payments made in this legislation, and it would also require repayment of payments made under this bill with interest, with a 10-year amortization at an interest rate of 8% or 3 points above prime, whichever is greater. And I would request a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, originally there were about 50-plus strains that were approved by the federal government for this, and they're down now to 15, I think, because the other ones were contaminated. And I'm not sure anybody is using any of the approved strains to do anything at the present time. What this amendment would do is make Minnesota a backwater state. California has put billions, that's with a B, billions of dollars into stem cell research in their state to make their state a leader. Wisconsin is spending hundreds of millions of dollars, and this amendment would be just the opposite of the states that we have to compete with. It would put us out of the running in the huge future that's involved in stem cell research. And this is a really bad amendment.
Representative Vandeveer, you know, we are going to have the Higher Education Committee's bill before us here in a couple weeks, and I just want to bring forward a suggestion. Would you be interested in offering this to the Higher Education Omnibus Bill instead? It does seem like it's a little bit more related to that bill than this particular bill, but it's certainly your choice as the author of an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had considered that, but what's nice about this bill is it goes out a few years. And so I think this is a good vehicle, and I think it's reflective of the fact that if you're going to take subsidies from the taxpayers, that there should be some accountability with how that money is utilized. So I think I'll keep the amendment here, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for you. You know, prior to the start of this session, you and I have had a discussion about how I felt like you may as well serve on Ways and Means because the other committees are meaningless because every bill comes here and it seems to be a free-for-all of changing it, and you assured me that, you know, you were going to deal with fiscal matters and limit the scope of that and things of that. And I was, I'll have to admit, somewhat suspicious that you'd actually be able to follow through on that. So I'm just curious, have your thoughts on that changed? Are we back to kind of
all bills just come to Ways and Means and then we do whatever we want? Why have the rest of the committees? Why not just have Ways and Means?
Well, Representative Dorman, Representative Vandeveer has offered an amendment.
I believe you're the chair, Mr. Chairman.
Are you in favor of giving me dictatorial power to rule on whether we pass or fail these amendments? I'm sorry, Representative Dorman. Representative Vandeveer has brought forward an amendment, and we need to conduct the process with his amendment.
So getting back to the process then, Mr. Chair, you assured me that, boy, I had it wrong, that you weren't going to micromanage every bill from the Committee on Ways and Means, and I'm just curious what the purview of the committee is.
Representative Dorman, I think you are aware of the purview of the Committee of Ways and Means, that it is dealing with ways and means, and in particular financial issues. Any financial issue that does directly or may indirectly impact the state of Minnesota is within the jurisdiction of the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Vandeveer has brought forward an amendment. Discussion of the A14 amendment. Representative Abrams.
Chairman, I would hope that members could vote no on this. You know, quite often in the legislative process, rather strange things happen. They don't only happen in the House, they happen in the Senate. You know, we are known for the circus bill. We are known for putting a gay marriage amendment onto a constitutional amendment dealing with taxes in the tax committee. The Senate has done some strange things over the years. And I think that when we get involved in these sorts of legislative actions of tying really Representative Vandeveer an unrelated issue to this, we don't diminish ourselves individually. We do diminish the institution. And your idea may have merit on some other bill. I can think of Representative Dorman, I believe, in the capital investment bill. I believe that there's some dollars for a biomedical science building on campus. I'm carrying Representative Vandeveer a initiative for biomedical sciences at the university for five buildings and creating a public authority. I would welcome this discussion on that bill. I do not welcome the discussion on stem cells on a bill dealing with the financing of a stadium to be placed on the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. So I would recommend a no vote, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do think it's kind of interesting that this amendment showed up on this bill, since the Memorial Football Stadium did have a long history in science, and I must say it was the site that one of the most famous scientists at the University of Minnesota conducted all his research, and that was a guy named Ansel Keys, who I believe was on the cover of Time magazine, and he's the fellow that invented K rations for World War II. He's the first person that thought that cholesterol might be bad for your health, and concocted what he called the Mediterranean diet. He lived to nearly 100 years. I think he just died about a year ago, and that diet certainly worked for him. So I guess it's appropriate to mix science and football stadiums.
Other discussion to the amendment. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not see how this is related to a football stadium issue. I do understand political blackmail when I see it, though, and I understand that the temptation to try and use this vehicle for other purposes than what it was intended for is very tempting to many. But I would encourage that we would not support this. I'm a strong pro-lifer. I've got 100% voting record on pro-life. But to use my pro-life position on this kind of an issue is, to me, very offensive. And I think it's inappropriate. And I will be passing on this vote. I don't have to vote no on something that I believe is a issue that I would, in appropriate form, would support. But when it's being inappropriately used, just for to try and put on something onto this bill that they know would going to conference committee wouldn't even be considered, just does, to me is just inappropriate and not respectful of the issue and of either issue. And I would encourage members just to pass on this one.
Other discussion. Representative Andevere.
Well, Mr. Chair, the idea that we don't do things in this committee that are unrelated is hysterical at best. But I will I would just say that when the public funds an institution to the extent that we do, and they announce as they did with, I think, just come out and pronounce that they are now going to start doing this like they did a couple years ago without consultation with the legislature, and we are funding the university with vast amounts of money, I think that we have the right to tell them how they are spending it. So I don't think there's anything unusual about the amendment being offered here in Ways and Means, and I have seen it. I mean, we just took over the Environment Committee's job. We just, members have not hesitated to bring forth any issue, so, I don't think this is any different in that respect. And members can vote how they choose on it. But it is not political blackmail. It is a good vehicle. It is giving the university hundreds of millions of dollars and of my constituents' money, and an institution that has, on occasion, been somewhat arrogant about the reception of that money and in dealing with my constituents. And I think the amendment is perfectly appropriate.
Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
MC?
Yes.
Abler?
No.
Abrams?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Beard?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Biskins?
Yes.
Carlson?
No.
Clark?
No.
Dorman?
No.
Doing?
No.
Earhart?
No.
Rowling? Gunther? Hamilton?
Yes.
Hilty? Holberg?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Kelleher?
No.
Clemzing?
No.
Krenke? Larson?
No.
Mariani?
No.
McNamara?
No.
Norris?
No.
Ochamba? Osmond?
Yes.
Hamer?
No.
Rukavina?
No.
Ruth?
Pass.
Seifert? Smith?
Yes.
Solberg?
No.
Decora? Vanderbeer?
Yes.
Bagenius?
No.
Walker?
No.
Knobloch?
Yes.
Breiling?
No.
Breiling votes no. Is there anyone else we missed that came in?
Gunther?
Gunther passes.
Could we hold the vote?
We could hold the vote for Representative Krenke.
There being 8 ayes and 21 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Solberg has an amendment. The A-17 amendment. Representative Solberg moves the A-17 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, this is comes a little bit at the request of counsel as well. At the present time, the bill as it goes through would be codified in the session law, not in statutes, and this would put it into the statute since it does last for 25 years. I think it's the proper place, instead of trying to find the little brown books to find out what it is, it'll be in the regular printed version.
And members, I had been alerted to this issue too, and I think this is an excellent amendment. I'd encourage you to vote for it. Any discussion of the A-17 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A-17 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A-17 amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, how would you feel about a couple of constitutional amendments?
Representative Abrams, someone can always raise a point of order to germaneness in this committee.
I'm getting close, Mr. Chairman.
Other discussion? Seeing no amendments. I'm sorry, Representative Abler.
Well, I just wanted to offer a comment. I came here to vote no today because I was troubled with the money, and I'm still in trouble with the money. The next thing we're talking about is the targets, and we don't have any money. We have a big lawsuit holding over our heads. We have a fiscal forecast that's real lean. But even that, with that being said, it seems that we can work out things. I've been persuaded in a discussion that the new monies actually benefit students directly, which kind of gives me some comfort. I was agreeable with the $7 million deal, and so I just thought people should know that, not that they care about how I vote or not, but I think there's a lot of strength in this argument. I can defend it to my constituents where I couldn't defend it before. And I don't know, we have the budget that we're going to inherit next year, those of us who come back, is going to be as lean as can be. And I hope members vote yes on this, knowing what they're going to be voting not to do next year, or they're voting for a tax increase. I want to remind members, though, that last year when the Senate tax increase plan came over, 16 members of the House voted yes, which means there's not a lot of support for a big tax increase. So as we do all this stuff we're going to do, we're going to hear a teacher's pension bill come forward, which we're hopefully going to support. We're going to support all the spending we're going to do in the next bill. We had better realize that even the U, as they bring this forward, is going to put their own funds at risk for next session. And so that we do that with our eyes open, not shut. And that next time, by voting for all these things we're going to be voting for this year, we had better be careful. So,
to the bill, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm prepared to vote yesterday, but I think that we've had a really important discussion on the land. And I actually was getting very sympathetic to the amendment that you offered, and I understand what the change would be. And I think it's really important to come back to that issue on the House floor. I personally think that the current language is simply unacceptable, and I'm prepared to vote yesterday, but I hope we get some good work done on it.
Well, Representative Bradley, I guess I thought the discussion we had on it was a good discussion today, and I am planning on bringing forward some sort of amendment on the floor. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Abler, I think that's an interesting statement. I mean, that was the Senate tax bill. I do believe that we had a proposal that was balanced, fair, and looked at things like closing corporate loopholes to provide some amount of revenue here. So I think it's very interesting, the statement today. I think it's a good warning. However, I do think you need to make sure that you are fair in your statements about what our side of the aisle has proposed, which has been a moderate approach to the budget, knowing that there are big problems coming and that we have to have our eyes wide open, as you said. However, I think it's also unfair to say that a bill crafted by the other body is absolutely going to be accepted by this body without some sort of input. So I appreciate your comments. However, when we get to the discussion of the targets, I think it will be really quite appropriate to talk about. So welcome.
Representative Abler to that point.
Yeah, and I wasn't actually looking to pick a fight, and I was just mostly trying to point out that, okay, well, stumbling into places I didn't mean to go. And the point being is that by doing things we're doing, we're setting ourselves up for some revenue needs next year, which we seem to have a hard time finding to agree on at the end of the day. So maybe I'll make that my statement and not the others.
Point well taken, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tamar.
Hang on, what happened to me?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a quick comment. Sorry I missed the committee meeting yesterday because I was in public safety most of the day. But I'm troubled by the bill, and I know it's going to pass out of here, I suspect, by huge margins and pass the legislature. And I would like you know, like many members here have fond memories of the old Memorial Stadium. I remember up as a young boy sitting with my dad at home. He'd listen to on the radio with an occasional glass of Jim Beam and listen to the Gophers on Saturday, living and dying with that team. And we used to come down to Minneapolis several times a year and go to old Memorial Stadium and love the old stadium. So I would like to see a stadium on campus, but what's troubling me is that we're going to be dealing with three stadium proposals this year. Three stadium proposals. And after the cuts that we've made in the last few years and the cuts that we made to the University of Minnesota, the university is losing research dollars. It's in terms of the top universities in the country, it has one of the lower faculty compensation rates. I just wonder where our priorities are. Three stadiums. Now, I don't pretend to have all the economic answers. I don't even, but when I think of having three separate stadiums, and I don't know if there was a possible solution to have the Vikings and the Gophers play in one stadium, and I understand that parking could be an issue on the campus, but eight home games for the Gophers, eight home games for the Vikings, at what cost? At what cost? And I just think something's wrong with our priorities. And as much as I would love to see this happen, it just is rubbing me the wrong way, and I don't think I can support it.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, I'll just pass after what Representative Paymar said, and Representative Abler's somewhat apology. But, you know, Representative Paymar brings up some good points. I'm going to vote for the bill today, Representative Paymar, somewhat reluctantly. But Representative Abler, you know, to imply that we haven't raised taxes around here in the last few years is absolutely not true. You can call a fee, whatever you want to call it, and people got in trouble in the governor's office and your side of the aisle calling a tax a fee. But there's been a lot of fees, and Representative Knobloch and I used to have this discussion all the time in this committee and on the floor, and he would tell me that a fee is something you got a service for. And we have gone away from that. I mean, there are people paying parking fees in this state, the parking ticket fees and nursing home fees, and we're charging little kids for milk now in grade school. We could call it a milk fee, you know, that have nothing to do with getting a service for that. So to imply that that we haven't raised taxes is just not true. I think Representative Paymar's speech is more to the point here. We've raised fees and that on people that have an inability to pay, including students at the University of Minnesota. And now we have the, I guess, wherewithal to decide whether or not to build stadiums. But it's going to pass, and I'm going to support it. And maybe, Representative Knobloch, some of your concerns can be met on the floor about the public actually getting a little more use of this property that we're paying for.
Okay, see no further discussion. Oh, Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's just sort of on a lighter note. Representative Paymar, when you were listening with your father, I was living in the same neighborhood your father grew up in.
Were you drinking Jim Beam too?
Not at that age, Mr. Chair. Only later. You know, it's kind of interesting to me that there's a piece of property that the university acquired in 1947 involved in this bill right now, because I happen to remember 1947 and 1948 and what went on in Memorial Stadium in those years. And Bernie Bierman was the football coach, and Minnesota had the greatest line in football history: Bud Grant, Leo Nomalini, Vern Gagne, and I can't remember the other two. We had a great university at that time, and we had a great football team. And those are not incompatible. And hopefully moving back on the campus that we never should have left will restore that football tradition and also help get the university back to the same level of greatness it had in 1947.
The last word, perhaps, from the off, well, Representative Carlson.
Just a quick comment. I wanted to join in earlier on the Memorial Stadium issue, and I just wanted to comment that there's at least one member of this committee that tried to keep them on campus originally, just for a bit of that history. You can guess who that might be.
Representative Abrams, the author of the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I believe that this is a good bill for the state of Minnesota, that there is value to the state in bringing football back to the campus that has Division I men's football. Additionally, it is our flagship and our research university, and that there and that this is an amenity. When you take a look at all of the various financing plans that are out there for various stadiums, this is the one that calls for the least amount of public involvement. And this is also the one that provides, I believe, the greatest public benefit. So, members, I thank you very much for the conversation. I look forward to seeing you all tomorrow on the floor, and also would like to thank Representative Solberg for his help on the bill, Representative McNamara, Representative Osmond for their help, and Representative Kelleher for her help. So with that, I think we're ready to vote.
Okay, with that, members, there being no further discussion, all in favor of House File 263 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Members, we are going to now break for lunch, and let's be back here at 12:30 to take up the targets. Recess till 12:30. RES7-1 resolution. And members, there is one oral amendment I need to make on this right away, where there's a typo in between the spreadsheet you've got and this resolution, and that is on page 1, line 11. It should be $75,250,000, not $72,250,000. So members, I'd incorporate that. And members, with that, let me explain the resolution. This is the targets resolution. And I guess maybe let me start on the back of the targets resolution, because this gives you a little bit more of an overview of what we're doing. I'm very concerned about making sure we account for the possible loss of the tobacco case, the State versus Philip Morris Incorporated. That is a contingent liability of $370 million. This resolution allows us to account for that contingency. And the way it does that is there is $316,716 in the tax relief account that we are transferring into the general fund that would go toward the tax target. Of that, my expectation is that roughly $49 million would be available in unrestricted tax cuts that the tax committee could choose to do no matter what might happen with the Philip Morris case. The remainder, $267,716,000, would be reserved for the potential loss of that case. And the tax committee could decide to simply not appropriate that money for tax cuts at all if they chose to, in which case that money would fall to the bottom line if we won the case, or they could appropriate money for tax cuts on a contingency basis and saying, for example, we're going to cut taxes assuming we win the case. And if we lost the case, those tax cuts wouldn't take place. If we won the case, those tax cuts would take place. And so that is a contingency with the tax committee that would be available for them to cut additional taxes if we won the case. With the Health Care Access Fund, we have a surplus of roughly $122 million, and we're proposing to take about $20 million of that for, again, unrestricted expenditures subject to where the Health and Human Finance Committee wanted to spend that money. That could be spent no matter what happens with the case. The remaining roughly $102 million would be reserved as a contingency in case we lose the tobacco case. However, the Health and Human Services Committee could write in contingency language just as the tax committee saying they wanted to appropriate this money for whatever purposes they chose to, subject to the case being won. And so it would be a situation where I can see them saying, you know, this $102 million, they could choose not to spend it at all if they chose to and leave it in the Health Care Access Fund as a surplus. They could choose to spend it on various items, but that spending would only take place if we actually won the case. Well, that is the sort of contingency aspect of the resolution, and I guess maybe I'll take a question on that if someone's got one. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about putting language in anything that's official about the law case. And the reason being that when Commissioner Ingerson testified before this committee on March 2nd, she was asked repeatedly about putting something in there about what would happen if we lost the case. And she said it was the historical precedent that we never did that, and that we did not want to put anything down in print that we might lose the case. And I actually have her quote here. And she said, and partly this is under the advice of the attorneys, that if we suggest that we are not going to have this money any further, that it would be a disadvantage, that it would disadvantage the appeal in the process. So it weakens your case in court if you start making allowances for losing. So I don't mind setting this money aside, but I don't think we should have anything down in print that says that we might lose this case. And I don't know if you've checked this the budget resolution with the commissioner, but she was quite clear that she did not want us to have anything in print.
I did review it with the commissioner last night, and she did not make any comment on that. But I did show her the language. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, this sounds like a deja vu all over again, that last year we had Plan A and Plan B. I would also echo, I think, the same type of concern. I think we've expressed that many, many times over again. No, we should be up front and just say that we're going to provide tax relief or not provide tax relief, instead of contingent upon one. If we win it, then we do this. That's how we got into some real difficulties last year. Just the same type of thing. We had Plan A and Plan B. We'd spend some money if we had this, and we spent different money if we had that. We brought those to the House floor, and we all know the difficulties that that type of budget planning created last time. Would also echo the cost, the concern that Representative Huntley has expressed. Ms. Ingus and the commissioner was quoted on tape to be careful about that. And I, as far from my knowledge on the law and that, I defer to some attorneys, but I would think that in her quotation she probably had good advice for us to be careful about that.
Well, I guess, Representative Solberg, I am trying to be upfront with everyone on it. The case is out there. Everyone knows it. I'm not an attorney. I don't have any idea if we're going to win or if we're going to lose. I'm told by the state that our case is strong and that we believe we're going to win, but I'm trying to be very upfront in terms of saying this is a contingency for what we're going to do if we do lose. And it's a large sum of money that impacts potentially the state, and I think that it's important to have some sort of plan on what we're going to do if we lose the case. And so that's the reason I've written it. I did, as I mentioned to Representative Huntley and this group, review this with Commissioner Ingerson last night, and she saw the language. We went over this language. She made no comment on the language saying she thought it was a bad idea or anything like that. But I do recall the comments that you spoke of previously. I guess let me go to the other side of it, and we'll continue to discuss this. Let me go over the target side, and we can get into, once I've reviewed that side of it, the discussion on the entire resolution, as well as that point if you want to discuss that further. I think what I'd like to do, Representative Carlson, is I'll just briefly go through them, and then we'll take questions. That way we can have the whole
resolution on before us. Members, on the front side, this is, of course, the targets for the remaining fiscal year ending June 30th, 2007. The limit for the higher education bill would be identical to that was proposed by the governor. Of course, we are just merely allocating funds in this particular resolution. It's up to the Higher Education Committee and later to be ratified by the legislature what we actually do, but I suspect there's a strong feeling for funding the University of Rochester in this amount, just as there was with the governor. There's $6.6 million for the education finance bill. There's $1 million for the agriculture and rural development finance bill. There's $10.5 million for environment and natural resources, and I guess the thinking behind that is we've been told that if we choose to do the Clean Water Legacy Act, the minimum amount that we need to do that and provide what needs to be done is $11 million, and the governor had a $500,000 saving item in the form of timber sales in his budget, and so this $10.5 million would certainly allow us to do that smaller clean water legacy bill if that was the choice of the legislature or the choice of the Environment Finance Committee with that target. Line 11 is $75,250,000. I'll remind members I had an oral amendment I incorporated when we started this, the Health and Human Services bill. $75,250,000, that's obviously the lion's share of the money that we are spending out of the $88 million total target. There is, I anticipate that the great majority of that would be going towards meeting the needs the state has in terms of appropriating additional money to lock up sex offenders, additional money to deal with mentally ill and dangerous, additional money for the salary supplement that was agreed upon. And I believe that we can cover those needs with this amount of money. There's a limit of $3 million for the state government finance bill. There's a negative number of $26,750,000 for jobs and economic opportunity. Members, the governor, as you may recall, proposed refinancing $10 million of TANF funding. We have, in further research, found that we can refinance $27.5 million of TANF money without running into any sort of problems with the federal government. This will be able to enable us to still meet our work requirements and such, but it makes additional money available. So we're proposing that, well, in this case, we have $26,750,000, but there's $27.5 million that can be refinanced and then leave the Jobs Finance Committee with some additional amount of money for other needs that they would have. There's $750,000 for the Transportation Finance Bill. There's $6,300,000 for the Public Safety Bill. Although members will recall that there's roughly $15 million in savings right off the top in the public safety finance bill because the number of people in our prisons is below the forecast. And so there's significantly more money than initially appears for public safety here. And finally, there's a limit of $6,779,000 for a capital investment bill. That is the amount of money that is needed to fund the debt service on the bill that was passed out of capital investment yesterday. People may look at the spreadsheet and wonder about the difference between the roughly $11 million that was the governor's target and the $6.7 million here and realize that our bill was larger, but the difference is the governor did spend a fair amount of general fund money on various capital projects in the bill, and the bill that we have passed in capital investment either does not include those projects or, for the most part, actually bonds for that general fund money instead, and we have checked with bond counsel and we can bond for that money. And so, members, this capital investment amount does allow us to do the bonding bill that was passed yesterday out of the bonding committee. With that, members, I am open to questions. Representative Park.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to see if I understood what you said about the Jobs and Economic Opportunity Bill.
Yes.
You said $27.5 million you think you can steal from TANF. So that leaves 26, and you're taking away 26,750. And you said that would be enough for that committee? If I get that right, that's $750,000.
Well, I said Representative Clark, that would leave $750,000 for the committee.
So the target for the jobs that includes housing and child care and all that, is $750,000. Is that what?
Well, actually, the target for the committee is a negative $26,750,000.
Right.
But there is $27.5 million in TANF refinancing that is available.
Well, like I said, I guess I heard right. I just wanted to hear if that's what you were saying, that you're recommending that all of the jobs and economic development, housing, child care, all of those parts of that that are in that committee, not spend more than $750,000.
Well, I'll not spend more than $750,000 in increased money over last year, Representative Clark. Remember that this is a two-year budget. We passed a budget last year to fund state agencies, including the agencies covered by the Jobs Committee, for the next 2 years. Some programs did get significant increases last year. I can't speak to every single program in the Jobs Committee and what finally happened there, but this is a budget resolution that deals, in my view, with emergency situations or changes that need to be done to the budget this year to make changes to conform with situations that have changed from the budget we passed last year that is already funding them for this last year and this next year.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I
could... Representative Park.
Could I just ask the chairman of our committee, the Jobs Committee, to say, I don't know if he has a running tally of the proposals that have been before, but many of them from your caucus... Representative Gunther, can you tell me what the requests are?
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, okay. I haven't tallied them all together, but they are very, very substantially more than this.
Yes.
Your requests are much more than this.
And yours, Mr. Chairman.
And mine.
I guess I'm just astounded that that's where the money is being taken from. I just, this is supposed to be a time of working on some of our economic opportunities and the incredible needs that are present in that committee. I guess I have to say it's very disheartening. And I guess if you don't know that there have been huge cuts as well in there, I would be glad to submit you a list. I mean, I can tell you we fought tooth and nail against all of the elimination of, for example, the governor's after-school youth program, his proposal. It was only by getting some help from the Senate that we got some of them back. You know, I mean, and there's many, many, many other examples of huge cuts that we're hoping to try to, bring forward. Because again, it is a jobs and economic opportunity committee, and when you don't give people opportunity, then you end up putting them on the other side of the ledger, where they're going to need to have funds from the health committee and all the others. So anyway, it's just disheartening.
Okay, well, Representative Clark, I would just say that I am aware that there were some real cuts in that committee last year, and certainly if you feel that there should be more money in that committee and less money in some other committee that's on this list, you are able to offer amendments today to redress that situation. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the resolution here on line 1.11, and maybe I wasn't listening with both ears while you were explaining, but it says there's a limit of $72 million in change. And then I'm looking at the little workup sheet. It says $75 million and change.
Oh, Representative Beard, you got
it. There was an oral amendment. Okay.
Yeah, we made an oral amendment to correct that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering about the $3 million that disappeared out of transportation for the airport fund. There's about six major projects, major to rural Minnesota, that are going to go unfunded for the year. And I was hoping that was the $3 million, and we just found it. But, alas, you've dashed my hopes.
Sorry. Representative Paymar. Sorry. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I would ask Representative Smith if he could talk a little bit about the requests and the needs in front of our committee, the Public Safety Committee. And I know this is not, I don't want to put you on the spot, Representative Smith, but it seems like this is not going to meet even close to the obligations and that we need to fund in order to maintain the public safety in the state of Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if you can speak to this. And I also see that there's people from the Department of Corrections here, and I was wondering, Mr. Chair, if I could ask the commissioner to talk about the impact of the supplemental budget on DOC.
Well, let me first go to Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar,
if you don't want to put me on the spot, then release me from answering this question. But I will respond, and I may over-respond, but just bear with me if you don't mind. The governor, I believe, has recommended more, maybe substantially more than the 6.3 that you see in these on these lines. I believe it's around 20.2, and frankly, to even cover what he's asked for, I will need more in our committee budget than the 6.3. Now, having said that, two other points. Last year, we produced House File 1, which we were blessed with, I think, a 15% growth in our budget at that time, with which we successfully attacked the meth scourge in the state. I believe reductions there are 80% in the bus. The meth production labs have been busted. We did a whole host of things last year, even things that were not that highly expensive. The strangulation felony issue, which, as you recall, and you've heard me brag to our committee that 10 minutes after midnight, after the bill went into effect, the first person was taken off the street in Hennepin County having strangled or attempted strangulation. So looking backwards just a bit, to look in the rearview mirror, we did really well for our state, you and I together, and admittedly we had 15% additional money to spend. Looking forward, I would like to see that 6.3 increased at least threefold in order to do what I consider some basic things as requested even by the governor. However, and as you well know, we've heard 116 bills in our committee this year, and I think we're going to be looking in just 5 weeks, and I think we're going to be looking at roughly 55 bills and to 56 bills included in a proposed omnibus public safety bill, thank God the bulk of which require little or no discernible cost, but which will go a long way towards addressing additional safety needs. I am worried, however, about some of the governor's recommendations that how we're going to meet them. So the answer is that.
Representative Paymar.
Sure, Representative Smith. In terms of the DOC's requests, do you see this as problematic in the overall fiscal portion of our omnibus bill, given the target that we have?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, I'm looking at my own notes for presenting to our committee tomorrow, as well as talking to you later today. I believe we have 11 line items for appropriations provisions, so I think we're including everything that has been requested of us, except the numbers don't quite add up to where I'd like to see them. That may be left for... I don't see us as failing in meeting these needs. It's not going to be easy.
Thank you. And I guess the commissioner, I think, of corrections had, you had referenced her coming forward, Representative Paymar?
I'd like to, if that's okay.
Sure. Commissioner Fabian, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I really appreciate this opportunity. I do have to say that we're going to be in dire straits if we don't get the entire 13.2 million requests. We have cut with per diem reduction over the last few years. We cut 200 positions in the prisons at the same time when all of the our intake has been expanding. We've had a 51% increase in the number of prisoners in the last 5 years. So this request last year, with the budget issues that we had, we didn't get the salary supplement in our budget. It comes to a total of $27.9 million. And when our prison population slowed down, I think people got the idea that there was savings to be taken someplace else. What we did was subtract the $14 million from the $27 million that we would need for these salary supplements and that's how it comes down to 13.1 that we're asking for. I just had a conversation with someone who was saying, well, wait a minute, you've got 4,000 people. It's not going to be any big deal to not have these positions. I'm here to tell you it is a huge deal. We will compromise the safety in every single prison that we operate now. We will have to lay off several hundred people, and at this point, last year in 2003, we laid off an additional 100, and that was mostly managerial, administrative-type positions. So the new layoff, if we don't get this $13 million, will be in the prisons, and it will really be a safety issue for our staff. You know, we just don't have it. We're understaffed as it is, and then to start laying off people because we don't have this. And this has to be paid. I mean, these are the union-negotiated increases. So, thank you.
Well, Commissioner Fabian, I guess to be fair, you're assuming that with a target of $6.3 million, you're not going to get your full salary supplement request. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming, yes.
Okay. Well, and I guess that is a situation for the Public Safety Committee to work out. But, you know, the Public Safety Committee, even if we gave you the exact target that the governor was recommending, wouldn't necessarily give you exactly what the governor was recommending.
No, I understand that. I guess I just wanted to make the case that, you know, I really have carefully looked at this, and, you know, we don't have any areas that it can come from, and I do understand that we have to make the case with Representative Smith as well, but
yeah.
I know that if he only gets 6.1 and I need 13, that we're in trouble.
And I know, Commissioner, that there are a large number of other budget areas that are in the Public Safety Committee's purview as well as corrections.
Great.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, if Representative Smith could help me out here, because I'm not on his committee and we're seeing this kind of in a backwards way. The governor had recommended that we have 10 new agents in this state, and it's my understanding that your committee, or one of the committees that I don't sit on, recommended that those 10 new agents go to the gangs strike task force, which I thought was, I do think, is incredibly important. Are you going to pay for them?
Representative Smith, do you want to take that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the omnibus bill that the Public Safety Committee is working on has not been put together yet. There will be no plans to add any agents to the gang strike force. There will be plans to create a special crimes unit consisting of 10 BCA agents. The cost is approximately $2.1 million. And that also will have to be balanced off against the request you just heard for salary supplements, along with several million dollars worth of other items. So, A, no, we're not adding to the gang strike force, and B, we're looking at 10 additional BCA units for agents for a special crimes unit, roughly costing around $2
million. Okay, if I could.
Representative Wagenius.
If I could follow up, I'm sure. Sorry, I got the name wrong, but the duty, I think I did get right. My basic question here: are we going to be able to fund those new agents, given the testimony we have just heard and the numbers we see on this page?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the Special Crimes Unit is in the top 11 line items that I'm going to be recommending to my committee and then to the House. Funding will be short, however, to guarantee you here and now that we'll be funding all 10 of them. But it is in the top 11 line items that will be put together in the Public Safety Committee. Out of about 56 line items.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to clear up a little misunderstanding with regard to the environmental figure. I think the Chair said that the Clean Water Legacy Act only needed $11.4 million for its first year of operation. Actually, when that question, as we did some research to find out where that came from,
And it seems that back in January, the question was asked House Research as to how much the Clean Water Legacy Act would need in its first year. And so that they did is they went back to the bill that was in taxes at the time and looked at the bill for the dollar amount that it was raised in its first year. It was based upon a fee structure that was proposed, and it would, in its first year of operation, it would, of course, been just partial of the year that it would have raised. So all that fee would have raised at that first year was $11.4 million. That's where the $11.4 million came from. It has no relationship to need. It just happens to be that that's what the a current fee structure would have raised. So they I just want people to recognize when we're talking about the $10.5 million for the environment that the even if we looked at the old fee structure, it called for $11.4 million. The proposal is that there's, because there's another $500,000 or $435,000, I believe, being raised in one of the forest accounts for new revenue, that's also being accounted for here. So that's how I'm supposed to come up with the $11 million for the Clean Water Legacy. It's drastically short, so I don't want anybody to believe that by funding a $10.5 million that we are coming anywhere near meeting the requirements or needs for Clean Water Legacy. It happens to be all that we can squeeze out of the system at this point in time.
I guess Representative Osmond, I guess I've heard different numbers out there in terms of how much people feel we can get by with in terms of the clean water requirement. And that's a, you know, it's certainly a subjective number for different people in terms of what they think is needed this year. But I appreciate your comments. I've got Representative Otremba and Clark. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the line for health, and you spoke earlier about the sex offender and support staff. That's an $83 million bill right there. And I have some strong interest in taking care of veterans, and their initial request was over $12 million, and the governor's was even $7.5 million. So that isn't even included in the health piece. And because of my strong interest, it seems like it's strange that we rally around the troops, but when the soldiers get old, we tend to look the other way.
Representative Bradley.
Okay. To that point, the amount for the sex offender and mentally ill and dangerous is about $64 million, so we're not quite as far off there.
Representative Clark.
Well, just going back to the public safety question for just a minute. Representative Smith, I want to make sure I understood something that you said. Did you say that 80-some percent of the meth program was a problem was solved? Were you talking about production of methamphetamine, or were you talking about the addiction or both? I just want to know what you were saying.
Mr. Chairman,
or Representative Smith.
Representative Clark, the number I was referring to was the reduction in meth lab arrests or busts has been reduced by 80%.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify about that because I mean, just, you know, I had the bill to deal with chemical dependency care that's needed, treatment that's needed, and methamphetamine comes way up high on the list, especially for greater Minnesota. And I was just wondering if I had missed something, because I don't think we've really even begun to deal with the treatment issues and the cost of that. But you're just talking about the production in Minnesota. And I guess what I've heard from some reports then is probably what I'm sure you back up, which is even though that was wonderful that we stopped the production in Minnesota and all the damage it does, we still, the meth problem itself has not gone down. It's just being imported from Mexico and other places right now. And actually, it's on the rise, as far as I know, in terms of addiction. Is that right?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I can't give you hard and fast numbers, but I will describe what I believe has happened over the course of the last 10 years and over the course of the last year since we passed, or almost a year since we passed the bill. Roughly 10 or 11 years ago, there were probably five to seven meth production plants or meth busts in the state of Minnesota. Five or six, I can't recall. They grew over a 10-year period of time to about 550 per year. So the explosion happened over 10 years, And the reduction from the 550 has been by about 80% in the last year, I think directly attributable to the result of House File 1 being passed. Clearly, if it took 10 years to produce a number of folks who have abused meth, gotten it, and therefore are in our prisons or in our treatment facilities, it isn't that back is not going to be broken overnight. Internal meth production in the state has been reduced by 80%. It has shifted to incoming from Mexico and elsewhere, and the governor has previously asked for BCA agents to interdict that, and so now our focus will have to turn to that. No, meth has not been eliminated, but the internal production has been reduced by 80% as a result of what we did last year.
Okay, I think we agreed on that. I just want to be clear, because I think what we know is that actually a methamphetamine addiction is actually rising, unfortunately.
Representative Otremba, I guess I went past you before you were done. I'm sorry about that. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bradley. The union contracts are about $17 million, so adding the dollar amount that you gave and the $17 million comes very, very close to $83 million that is necessary for the sex offender program and the support staff, as I prefaced in my opening statement.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was interested in the education proposal that you brought forward, and as most of us can see here, the governor had recommended a little over $27 million. You're at $6.6 million. And when I look at what the governor's proposals were and the governor's priorities within that $27 million, your budget really concerns me greatly. You know, we talk a lot about investments in Minnesota, and I've always felt one of our best investments is in education. And some of the things that the governor was proposing are absolutely vital today. He talks about higher standards in his budget. I would argue that he perhaps isn't putting nearly enough into his budget to establish that.
Excuse me, Mr. Carl. Let me interrupt you for just one second. I want to tell people there is a journalism student from France who is in the room who has requested to take some pictures of the committee. And so I sent a note back that I thought that was okay. If anyone's got any objection, let me know. But I just don't want you to be wondering what's going on if photos are being taken. So
can we get our hair combed first?
For some of us, it's hopeless, Representative Silver.
I agree with you.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Representative.
Appear in a French newspaper, is that it, Mr. Chairman? Or
Who knows?
Who knows, right?
That's okay.
But going back to where I was in terms of high standards to make Minnesota more competitive, and that was what one of the investments was. You know, the governor talked about increasing opportunities in advanced placement and international baccalaureate, two excellent programs that we should be building on, and I don't think under your budget we're going to be able to do that. There's been a lot of interest in Minnesota, what we can do in the area of math and science, both in terms of curriculum change, and that was in the proposal, as well as the educating of teachers. And I recall before the Education Committee a few years ago, it was pointed out that the area, especially science, in the elementary schools is one of the most popular subjects there is, and something happens when you move into secondary. And the drop-off in the interest in science and students taking science courses greatly increases. Part of that proposal was to redesign math and science courses, and I would hope to focus on, you know, on that kind of an issue, what we can do to encourage more students to get involved with math and science. And that, of course, is the building stone for our colleges and universities in terms of producing more engineers and people involved in other scientific endeavors. So I'm concerned that what you're proposing here is a major step backward. When I look at what was on the table with that 27-4, the whole area of early childhood, and I suspect everybody in this room has probably been in the room at one time or other when people like Art Rolnick have spoke, when various business community leaders have come forward and they've talked about the advantages of early childhood education. And there were several initiatives there to provide educational opportunities in early childhood and to expand in some of those cases situations where children currently are eligible for early childhood education programs that under this budget would have been eligible. They would have had that opportunity. But my recollection when Art Rolnick is speaking on this issue is $1 invested pays $7 in dividends. And he uses an economic model to address that. And I'm not sure that we can even begin to address the issues, and I could go on even further with the $6.6 million that's in the House budget resolution relative to the $27.4 that was in the supplementary budget proposal by the governor.
Representative Sikora.
I would just like to respond to that a little bit, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, we would like to have more money. But I think if you recall, the governor's initiatives were all new things. Last year, we did fund education. We funded it rather well, as a matter of fact. I remember some of you being rather jubilant that we were able to give 4% and 4%. So it was $800 million. Dollars that we put into education, so that it was 4 and 4 plus the opportunity to go into QCOM and have even additional money, training for teachers, the opportunity for teachers to move up in their profession. I feel like we did quite a bit. And by the way, the early childhood piece that the governor proposed, I wanted very much to have that in my bill. However, that was killed in the policy committee by a motion from your side of the aisle.
Let's see. Representative Crossell, let me just briefly say in response to your statement that, you know, we had a very large dollar increase for education last year of something like $800 million in total funding from all sources. This was a two-year budget we passed last year. As I looked through the budget this year, which is supposed to be a supplemental budget for, in my view at least, emergencies, deficiencies, other things that have come up, I guess I didn't see a large number of items I considered emergencies or deficiencies in the education area, and I felt that the funding increase that we gave out last year was sufficient and that we should continue along the plans of what we had set out for education last year. Let me go to Representative Greiling and then back to Representative, or if you want to respond to that, go ahead.
I wanted to point out that not everything that I was talking about is a new program. As I referenced near the end of my comments, one of the early childhood education initiatives was to provide funding for students that are current or children that are currently eligible and their needs not being met. And that clearly was a big part of it. I think it was about $4 million, if I'm reading this correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So there are initiatives that aren't totally new relative to the comment about the early childhood and the action in Representative Biskin's community or committee. Everybody knows community. Yeah, okay. The everybody knows that the issue there was a distribution question that has to be resolved metro-rural, and I don't think that in any way potentially killed the bill. I think what was being desired there were the various players to get together to come up with a distribution system that would be satisfactory to both the metro and the rural area. But be that as it may, there were a lot of good initiatives that are being passed over, but I'll stop at this point because there are others that are involved with education that want to comment as well.
Okay, let me go. I've got Representative Huntley from earlier and Greiling. Representative Huntley, did you want to speak to the education area? Or else I can do Representative Greiling and go back to you. Okay, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Carlson made some very good comments, and we had the governor's initiative with some reform in it. He talked about it again last week at the Science Museum, and the budget, the target that we now have before us for education is less than a quarter of the funding that even the governor put in. It isn't even enough to do any more than half of his early childhood initiative, not to mention the other things that he had in his proposals for gifted and talented and for redesign of high schools, which is going on nationally. You know, we all have to pick and choose with Sophie's Choices, and you know, it's just a mere pittance. And Representative Sikora's comments about the great funding for last year, you know, this committee knows just as well as Education Finance Committee knows that when you have a year that's fairly good, you have to put it in context of the horizon. And if you have a nice size hill, but you've had flat plains or valleys in the 3 years before that, where you've actually cut education with a valley, and you've had 3 years of plains, and now we're back to another plain, you know, all of that, you have to worry what would happen then, you know, if there isn't any money again next year, if we don't have another 3 years of drought, and then that one good year, you know, looks even less than it did on top of what came before it. As far, I just wanted to comment briefly, too, on the what happened in ed policy with the education early childhood bill, and Representative Sikora, you know that charge to kill that bill was led by a Republican. And it was Representative Heidgerken who was very upset about the rural loss of seats for Head Start. And he did work with the Democrats as we were trying to come up with a better plan, and some people worked on it. We didn't come up with one yet. But now, even if we do come up with a plan, we have, even if we spent all this money on early childhood, only half of the governor's initiative in that one area could be funded. So I think that's a much bigger point than a temporary blip on the road with working out a formula.
Representative Huntley and Silver.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to start out on health care spending in the general fund. And as Representative Otremba said, the governor's request, which he listed as emergency items for the Department of Human Services, was you can get up to $83 million just on the state-operated services for number one, the additions, the emergency things he needs for the sex offenders that are being put in a state hospital, and also if you add in the we had the commissioner of corrections here talking about the budget shortfalls if we don't take care of the salary adjustment, it's even worse in the Department of Human Services. They need $17 million just to meet the negotiated contract with the unions. So just with the state-operated services addition that the governor declares our emergencies, we need $83 million, and we only have $75 million. And that does nothing for what the governor proposed for veterans. And he said if we don't add something to the veterans' homes, we're going to have to put a moratorium on admissions. So, again, we're trading off putting criminals in a hospital versus putting elderly vets in a nursing home. Do I understand those? Am I correct in that, Mr. Chair?
Representative Huntley, what I would say is that you're assuming that in the $8 billion budget that is the Health and Human Services budget, that there's not one dime of other money that could be found somewhere to perhaps be reduced through efficiencies or other reprioritization to pay for other things. And I guess I would like to think that there is some other money available.
And then, Mr. Chair, the Health Care Access Fund, it seems to me that you're saying we're going to spend about $20 million out of that if we put aside the roughly $100 million for the tobacco settlement?
Representative Huntley, this would allow $20 million roughly to be spent unrestrictedly, the other money to be spent if we did win the tobacco lawsuit.
And Mr. Chair, did I hear you say that that $20 million would be going to the university Mayo Clinic?
You did not hear me say that, Representative Huntley. That is something that I anticipate would be worked out with the Health and Human Services Committee and potentially this committee in terms of coordinating with where that money goes, potentially in the jurisdiction of other committees.
No, Mr. Chair, if there's only $20 million there, the U of M Mayo genomics program was $18 million, and the governor had roughly $59 million worth of requests out of the Health Care Access Fund for this biennium. And obviously we can't, if it's $20 million, we can't do Mayo. We can't do anything with the MSHA assessment. Or we could do Mayo, but then we couldn't do anything for the MSHA assessment. There'd be nothing for pandemic flu. There's an article in this morning's paper in Minneapolis, paper about what we ought to be doing and worrying about flu. The governor had a proposal for $10,500,000 to prepare for that, and with this budget resolution, there isn't going to be money to do any of those things. It's one of the five or six things the governor wanted, and some of which he declared are emergencies. And I think being prepared for avian flu influenza is something that's certainly going to the heading of an emergency.
Well, Representative Huntley, I would just say that, again, there is the opportunity to put all those things the governor requested and more in as expenditures out of the Health Care Access Fund if we feel that that is something we want to do as part of the contingency. I'm a little bit surprised to hear you arguing the governor's point of view that we should be taking money out of the Health Care Access Fund for all those things. That's not been something I've normally heard you argue in the past. But in any case, let me just say that if that's something you think we should do, we can put it in the Health and Human Services bill as a contingency. And I have some hope that we're actually going to know what the outcome of that case is before we are out of session. And then those items will have made it to conference committee. And based on the information we will have regarding the lawsuit, we'll be able to then make good decisions as to what to do.
Well, Mr. Chair, in addition, there's nothing in this resolution that will allow us to fix the problems that counties are facing due to the federal budget cuts and how they treat mentally ill. And I would also say that the governor's initiative for a mental health system transformation is only in next year, is $1.8 million, so we might be able to squeeze something in, but there's nothing allowed there to take care of the problems that the counties are having with federal cuts. And I will say you're absolutely correct that I don't think we ought to spend a penny out of the Health Care Access Fund for anything except Minnesota Care. And we've taken in the last 4 years $580 million out of the Health Care Access Fund, which could have been used to provide health care for working folks. And your budget takes $20 million out of there, and plus puts another about $100 million that could be removed from the Health Care Access Fund if we happen to win the or lose the court case. If we win the court case, you're telling us, well, we can just spend that money. So either way, you're taking at least $120 million out of the Health Care Access Fund to use on things other than providing health care to working folks.
We aren't saying we have to spend the money, Representative Huntley, and if we choose to just simply keep the money reserved and not spend it on all those things, I wouldn't necessarily object to that. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Let me respond to a couple of things. You said that you can always find efficiencies, and that's true, probably. I remember the efficiencies that we were finding in the transportation to be able to pay off the bonds that were sold, and I'll show you how the efficiencies have affected Highway 65. I invite you to drive up on it. I invite you to try to drive up on it at speed limit of 55, the major highway in Minnesota, south of McGregor, and the efficiencies have taken all kinds of tolls on our transportation system to pay off bonds that were sold. Well, sometimes there's a give and take in efficiencies. That may sound like a good thing to do, but quite frankly, there's no free lunch. And there's, when you fund something from somebody else suffers. And that efficiency was the highways in rural Minnesota. I'm a little concerned about one thing. I wonder if Representative Osmond could answer a question. He referenced the forestry account. That's been back and forth. Both political parties have dealt with that. That's the account that is used for reforestation after the state sells timber sales. Did you reference that there was some excess money in there and you expect to take that out, or you're looking at possibly using that for other resources? I don't want to put you in a spot, but you piqued my interest on that.
Representative Osmond?
Chair, President Tolberg, I'm not sure what the committee will decide, but that is when we were told that there'd be $11 million need for, or going to be provided for, Clean Water Legacy Act, and we were deducted another $500,000 because our ledger did show $400,000 in that forest account as new revenue. That's my understanding. So that's how they got to the 10.5.
Yeah, Representative Fulberg, and that is correct, although there is another roughly $2 million of timber sale income that is not flowing into the general fund, that's flowing into some other special funds that perhaps would be available for the purposes you are describing.
Mr. Chairman, the timber sales is a revolving account, and we put it in the special fund for a reason. Because when you have timber sales, in order to have future timber sales, you have to do some reforestation. And that was a revolving account all the time. And, if you want to have a future natural resources industry, in the wood products industry, in Minnesota, and 50% of those people are employed in the metropolitan area that are directly related to the wood fibers industry. We've had this fight, and it's not been a Republican or Democratic administration. It's been both. And I want to try my best to keep that money in, and we fought to put that in that account because that's where the money comes from, and that's where it should be used for reforestation. It sends a huge signal. The company like UPM Kymeny in Finland, as they are deciding where to build another paper machine, in Germany or in Grand Rapids. And that's a huge signal for them. It's one of the things they look at. I just want to put that out on the table of warning.
Well, Representative Silver, let me have Mr. Marks talk a little about more of those accounts. I'm not sure if it's quite the situation you believe.
Mr. Chair, members, the governor's proposal, and I don't understand it very well, but I'll just read this. It says it would implement a bid guarantee payment to reduce the risk of default on timber sales permits issued by DNR, and then the proposed front-end payments are phased in over 2 years and will result in a one-time shift forward in future timber sales for 2007 and 2008. The total revenue realized by this is about $2.7 million, $434,000 of it's in the general fund. There would also be additional revenue in the natural resources fund, the permanent school fund, and the special revenue fund, or there essentially is moving money forward by the proposal. And as I said, I don't understand the mechanics of the proposal. But
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
I just wanted to have that cautious, and we'll find some additional information as well on the work of the chair on that. Mr. Chairman, there's one other concern that I have. In your state government budget, you have $3 million. I serve on that finance committee. The chair isn't here, but I think they just finished their bill this morning. Representative Hilty would confirm this. I think the expenditure is close to about a little over $2 million within that budget. But that's all being raised by sale of land. So it's we're going to sell some land to fund this program. I do not have it with me, and I should go up to my office. It's too much of a mess to find someplace. But, we balanced the budget 2 years ago by saying we're going to sell a bunch of state property. We made that commitment mostly because you had the BCA building on University Avenue to be able to do it. Then last year, I think, if I recall right, we said we're going to balance the budget. We're going to sell a little over $6 million, I think it was, in land again. I don't remember the figures, but it's roughly that. We had a report from the Department of Administration early on in this session that they've reached about one-third of their goal on that. Now we're going to add some more sale of land. And I talked with one of the assistant commissioners of DNR last night. He said, we're not going to meet the goal. So, you're balancing a budget on some really, really big quicksand. Now, let me talk about the $3 million that's in there. The other program, major program, was there was for veterans. And the governor's proposal for veterans, if I recall right, he has $3 million for the State Soldiers Assistant Grant. He has some county vet servants, $3 million. A campus veteran assistant offers $2.5 million, plus veterans home, and that may be under another category of $7 million. It might be in the Department of Human Services as well. But if I just take those direct ones to the veterans, it's $8.5 million. You know, at a time when all of us salute our veterans, at a time when we all stand proudly by our flag, I'm extremely concerned about what's going to happen with the programs that the governor has initiated on that.
I don't see Representative Cipher here to respond on that, Representative Solberg. I guess I would just briefly say that I've heard that there are some of those programs the governor recommended on the veteran side that are more popular and have been met with greater acceptance than others, and that as we look through the total target for the state government finance bill and what could be done, this is an amount that we felt was sufficient to deal with the programs on the veteran side in terms of additional spending that needed to be done, plus the ongoing other costs and changes they needed to make.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that the governor and his staff have reviewed with his being a very conservative person these programs are needed.
Okay, members, just so you know where we are, I've got Representative Osment, Vandeveer, Kelleher, Greiling, and Bradley. Representative Osment.
I think, Mr. Chair, when we have a major spending bill that does some creative work, such as selling state assets and then respending the money, is that over and above the target, or does that money have to be included in the target?
Representative Osment, that's something that would be netted out within the target. So, for example, if someone spent $1 million selling land and then if someone gained $1 million selling land, then they spent $1 million on additional spending for some area, their target would be zero, not counting anything else that went on. So if you're asking about this, I mean, if you're looking at the state government finance bill, if they sold $2 million of additional land in their bill plus this $3 million, they would have $5 million additional to spend.
That's what I wanted to know, Mr. Chair.
All right, just trying to make sure I could answer your question.
Mr. Chair, let me respond to that. One of the things that is happening, though, you have to keep in mind that much of our spending is ongoing, and we're going back to what I said, you're building a budget on quicksand. And if it's an ongoing budget, all you have to all we're worrying about in here is getting through this biennium. You know, Governor Carlson, they came in, he said, we need to have a longer-term look at it. You need to be enacting spending priorities with a way of having an ongoing, if it's an ongoing obligation, you have to have an ongoing revenue stream. And not just say, well, we're gonna sell some things. And by the way, the Assistant Commissioner Holson said, we're not going to meet the obligation we had from last year's.
Well, Representative Solberg, I would say this budget is far from being built on sand. We have $370 million set aside in case we lose the tobacco lawsuit. If you presume we are going to win it, as the governor does and as the state's position is, we have a $1.1 billion surplus in the next biennium, not counting inflation. And so I think we have a very responsible budget and are in the best budgetary situation that we've been in a number of years. Representative Vandeveer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just surprised to hear we have the DNR trying to sell land. Isn't that like having the asking the cat to cough up the goldfish. We might want to look at a different way of doing that. But I do have one comment. I think it seems to me if we are taking the long view, we would want to, especially addressing the ups and downs in education and the ups and downs in funding, that we might want to start by not spending every last dime that's sitting around here this year in a non-budget year and go with a plan like this that does that.
Well, thank you, Representative Vandeveer. And just people should know that actually in this case it's not the cat coughing up the goldfinch. It's the Department of Administration that is selling the land.
Right.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I've been listening carefully to the conversation. It sounds like if we made our motion again on your budget resolution number, we might have a few more joiners on the other side of the aisle about how they feel about this now that they're seeing the targets. But I actually wanted to ask Representative Carlson a question since he has a little bit of experience around here, and I've been here for 8 years, and I've seen a few things and a couple interesting budgeting things. You know, we had Plan A and Plan B last year, and now this year on page two of this, we seem to have something that's even more interesting. I mean, we heard the Commissioner of Finance's words earlier that Representative Huntley read into the record about whether it's wise to put this sort of language forward at all or not, which I think clearly her testimony before this committee was not to do that sort of thing. So, Representative Carlson, I'm just curious. I mean, you've been here longer than I have. Have you seen this sort of, I don't know, I guess I'd call it sort of slippery language?
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, Representative Kelleher. I go back about 34 years when you say I've been here a while, I would have to say that I can't recall a single instance where we've had this kind of language, this kind of slippery slope. When I saw this language yesterday, we have a member that you and I both know that likes to every once in a while say something is totally unacceptable, and that's the category I would put this language in.
Well, Representative Carlson, can I ask you, do you think we should not have any sort of reserve for the possible loss of the lawsuit?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what we were talking about earlier, first of all, this is a kind of a false commitment to the taxpayers who might choose to rely on that because it may never happen. That's one issue. But the other issue I think Representative Huntley clearly brought up, and that's what the impact of this is on the courts. If you're asking me if I would like tax relief, the answer to that is yes. I indicated when the resolution was before us the other day that I felt tax relief should be a high priority, and personally, the tax that I would focus on happens to be the property tax, although it's been a few years since I've been on the tax committee, so others will have to decide if we are fortunate enough to have tax relief, what kind of tax relief that would take, but with the huge increase in property taxes, that's what I would advocate.
Okay. Let's move along. Representative Dreiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was going to put in a footnote after Representative Huntley's comments on the health care access fund, so I'll just be very brief at this point. But I did read in the paper this morning that one of the clinics that treats a lot of people who don't have health insurance was having to close because its small percentage of people who did have health insurance was shrinking. And I think that's the sort of thing that is very related to us always robbing the health care access fund and declining the eligibility for Minnesota care. That's the fund was there so we could have more and more people be insured and there could be more and more clinics that would be available for people. So we're definitely going in the wrong direction, and then they show up at the emergency room and that costs us more money. So I think we're Representative Vandeveer, to have this kind of a shrunken budget doesn't serve us very well even when we're trying to save money.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thinking and reflecting about an hour and 15 minutes as I leave here, I might suggest to you that we might just as well admit that we're going to do annual budget. We seem to spend the time. We might just as well do it, I admit. You reminded people very well that we already did the budget last year. And let me use, because some people brought up the Health and Human Services budget as a for instance, The Health and Human Services budget for this biennium increased 15.6% over the prior biennium. The additional money, and I'm not particularly wild about doing it, we're really caught with what are really emergency things. I mean, there's been a reflection on both sides of the aisle of things that we don't have a lot of choice in. That will grow the budget another 1%. We'll be up to 17% really growth in this budget. But it just feels like, as I sit here listening to people, that we've somehow lost track of a biennial budget process, and you might want to think. I think the other interesting observation I make is that I don't seem to recall in 2003 or 2005 such a propensity to use the governor's budget as a standard as I have today. Thank you.
All right. Other discussion.
Just one comment. I've never seen the other side of the aisle walk away from the governor's budget as fast as they have it today.
Representative Earhart.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know. This is not an appropriate place, but is there any provision made for the flood mitigation that we will surely be facing here before long? The people, the river rats from the northwest part of the state will be down here for money, and have we made provision for that in one of the emergency funds here? Or?
Representative Earhart, that would be an item that I would say is in the bonding bill. The bonding bill has, if I recall correctly, something in the neighborhood of $20 million for flood mitigation.
Oh, thank you.
Now, much of that is reserved for various projects, but I think that there is money in the bonding bill to deal with that. Representative Colbert?
I'd be a little careful of saying that money in the bonding bill is probably going to be used for the same type of problems that some of the people may be experiencing in the flood. Bonding bill flood mitigation is mitigation. It's not helping to clean up. You can't use bonding to solve some of the problems that are caused when you have a flood. It's flood mitigation grants, not flood fixing, helping grants. Yeah. That's general fund.
All right. And that's a reasonable point, Representative Solberg, but I don't know if we're going to have any requests in for that before the legislature is over yet either.
Okay.
With that, members, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that we adopt the KM-RES7-1 resolution. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The resolution is adopted. Members, we have one other bill before us today. Representative Emmer. The chair will move that House File 3002 be recommended to pass and referred to the Jungle Register. Representative Emmer, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House File 3002, after listening to your stimulating discussion over the past half hour, I think you'll be happy to know has everything to do with maintaining the integrity of some of our public programs. House File 3002 addresses or creates a durational residency requirement for general assistance benefits. Right now, general assistance can be found in Chapter 256 of the Minnesota Statutes. There are specific eligibility provisions within that chapter that vary, but it's basically a 30-day requirement, residency requirement. This proposal would extend that. It would be a 90-day residency requirement before an applicant could start to collect general assistance benefits. And with that, it's that basic, Mr. Chairman. I will stand for questions.
Representative Solberg.
It's kind of interesting to look at the fiscal note on this one, on the second page of it, the assumptions. And it says, although savings would be achieved, if a 90-day residency restriction were successfully implemented, it is likely but not certain that we would be enjoined from implementing.
Right.
Therefore, the certainty is not sufficiently adequate to book any savings. I mean, I got two problems with that. One of them, I think, we determine whether or not it's eligible or not, constitutional. And then the second thing, the courts will determine that. But at the same time, then, to say that we're going to save money when Fiscono says zero on it, because you're not going to accomplish it. I mean, it may be a good political statement, and we always want to go rah, 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 but this and a buck and a quarter will buy you a cup of coffee that I give you.
You can get coffee for a buck and a quarter?
Well, sure. Someplace in Bovee you can. Didn't say where.
Well, Representative Solberg, I guess we aren't actually, I believe, booking any particular savings for this bill. Although, having said that, we are hopeful that some significant amount will be available. Representative Carlson.
Just as a follow-up, you know, we've had this question before us before, and it's always been ruled unconstitutional, hence the zero savings. I would only footnote it and argue that it's going to actually have a cost. That's the one exception I would take with the fiscal note. Not zero savings, but just simply the cost of the court case. Put us through it one more time where it's been time and again ruled against us when this is passed. It's virtually tied up in the courts almost immediately.
Representative Emmer.
If I could respond to that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, this same proposal has not ever been before this body. In fact, if you go back, and you were probably part of the legislature that voted for a proposal back in 1991, maybe I should be careful when I say you probably were here. 1991, there was a six-month proposal that passed the legislature. That was a time when there was a discussion about budgets much like there is now. That six-month proposal was ultimately determined to impinge upon the right to travel, the fundamental right to travel under the Constitution. Justice Simonette wrote the opinion. The case, I've got it if you would like the cite. Regardless of whether I think the opinion was flawed or not, that's not the issue. That's the one you're referring to, that it's been here before. In 1997, the federal government rewrote how America's welfare system works and passed a bill called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. That act provided congressional approval for durational residency requirements. And if you'll recall, after that act was passed, the legislature again, and I suspect you were one of the folks that voted on it, the legislature again passed a durational residency requirement, this time a year. So what I'm proposing to you today is 90 days. The one that was passed in the early 90s, which did not have any congressional direction, was in fact a 180-day or a six-month durational residency requirement that was held unconstitutional for the reasons I've given you. The one that was passed in the late 90s, 1996, 97 in that neighborhood, was a one-year durational residency requirement. And that was challenged in a case that was ultimately heard by the Honorable Roland Farisee in the Ramsey County District Court. Judge Farisee, following some of the same reasoning that was used in the early 90s, issued a temporary injunction. The answer was never ultimately made, or the decision was never ultimately determined, because the Department of Health subsequently withdrew its appeal after a case in California said that a year is too long. The reason I'm here before you today is because a year is too long. I don't think 6 months is too long, but I'm not proposing 6 months. In fact, for our Minnesota care programs right now, we require 180-day residency, and that's never been challenged. I'm proposing a modest residency requirement of 90 days, which, if you look to our neighboring state, Wisconsin, where a 60-day residency requirement was, in fact, approved prior to the federal law that I've referenced, I think the proposal is entirely reasonable, and I would just suggest that before anyone here decide that this has been here before us in the past and that it's regularly been determined to be unconstitutional, that you please review the actual history of these court decisions and what we're addressing. I think you'll find that this one is not only reasonable, but it's appropriate.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demers were you referencing the U.S. Supreme Court decision in California on the last court case? Or
what? Yeah.
Representative Emmer.
That was the Sanez versus Roe, because that was
that
the,
is the...
Is that the one you were
referencing? That is the case, Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar.
And you don't, Mr. Chair...
Representative Paymar.
You don't believe that that ruling would have an impact on a court challenge here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, again, Representative Paymar, if you take a close look at that ruling, you'll see that that's a one-year durational residency requirement, which I think would be distinguishable from this proposal.
Representative Walker, Wagenius, Clark, and Carlson. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, how do you see this being moved ahead? How would one verify that they've been in the state for 90 days?
Representative Emmer?
I believe just the way they do now. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, you have to establish that you have not only been a resident, which you can do several different ways, but you can also you must also indicate that you intend to permanently reside here in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, for individuals that... they have moved out of the state for, lived here for 25 years and moved out of the state for 6 months and thought they were going to be starting off, don't you think that they should have a right to come back and if something happens within 30 days, be able to access our public service, our public services?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first, that is taken into account that if they came back, they would actually have to establish residency again. You are correct about that. But I might reference the Minnesota Family Investment provisions, which provide for an undue hardship situation. I suppose that's a possibility, Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer. The hardship... I mean, that would still be up to a social worker to determine what level of hardship. And the reason why I'm doing this is because actually I'm bringing this up because I have a couple constituents that did this, and actually a niece that moved to New York and became a resident of, New Jersey, became a resident of New Jersey, but had to come back home. And... we looked at the possibility of her getting on assistance for a short period of time while she was looking for a job. Ended up not doing that, ended up having her stay with someone, but she would be an individual that necessarily wouldn't be under hardship, but with your type of a bill would keep her from being able to access services from the state, although she had lived here for years and had paid Minnesota taxes, gone through Minnesota school, families here. It's just that out east didn't work out for her.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, you are correct. That is what my proposal would do, but let's emphasize for a period of 90 days, not forever. And then what I'd like to emphasize for this committee is we're talking about maintaining the integrity of the programs we offer. Keep in mind there is no constitutional requirement that a state provide a standard of living to its citizens. And in fact, many states do not have or provide for general assistance like the state of Minnesota. I think that this state has always been committed to make sure that there is an option for those that are less fortunate and need help. This proposal is simply trying to ensure that we maintain the integrity of the programs we offer so that perhaps someday we aren't faced with a decision which is cited in one of these decisions where Michigan actually had to drop its welfare benefits.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just end. I won't get into the whole idea of the other individuals from outside of Minnesota coming here. I would just keep focused on the fact that we have many individuals that move around the country for whatever reason, and like you said, may not have a requirement. We do have a tradition of taking care of our own. And for whatever reasons, individuals come back home and end up in hardship. 90 days may not seem like a long time to you, but if you don't have a savings or a family that can lend you a couch or a family that already has a different relative on the couch, 90 days is a long time to be on the street with possibly no money and trying to find shelter and have a job and be stable within that 90 days.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, because I just want to make sure that the record is clear for Representative Walker. I have never once suggested that 90 days is not a long time. I think it depends on the person's perspective or their eyes that we look through. A day may be an eternity to somebody. Please keep in mind that my proposal is simply from the standpoint of trying to maintain the integrity of the programs that we already offer so that those people that have to wait 90 days if this proposal would pass would in fact have something to wait for. And maybe that's just the difference that we have.
Representative Ember, before I go to the next person, as I'm looking at the bill, page 2, line 9, I'm wondering if there's a small technical correction that needs to be made, and that is it says effective July 1st, 2005, the amount of assistance paid, etc. Should that be 2006?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a small, minor oral amendment.
Okay, the chair will move that on page 2, line 9, 2005 be actually 2006. Any discussion of that oral amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Okay, I've got Representative Wagenius, Clark, Carlson, and Solberg. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I had been hearing around, since I'm not on Health and Human Services, that there was a bill out and about that would make it so that some folks who are, some young women who are pregnant could not get prenatal care. Could this be that bill?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, no.
Representative Wagenius.
So there would be no consequence under this bill for somebody who is pregnant?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, if you're familiar with the General Assistance Statute, it's intended for single adults, for coupleless children, and for certain adult children. It would be the Minnesota Family Investment Program that would apply to families with children.
Representative Wagenius.
You know, it's possible that somebody could be pregnant and not have another child. So I am asking about a single woman without children, because that's entirely possible, who could be pregnant. Could this bill apply to such a person?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I don't know that I can answer the question that you're asking. This bill is a durational residency requirement that I guess I don't believe so. I think the answer to your question would be no, but perhaps staff has a different take on it.
We'll see if we can get an answer for you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, well then, if you're going to get an answer on my first question, then you'll need to get an answer on my second question. I am most interested in prenatal benefits, and that I am most interested in the 3 months when someone is first pregnant. And for example, just as an example, a diabetic young woman should be counseled immediately to take vitamin C, at least her child have all sorts of deformities. And counseling to take vitamin C, a very inexpensive thing and an expensive amount of counseling, could save us multi-millions of dollars. So I think that's an important thing for us to know if this goes forward.
Mr. Chairman, it suddenly occurs to me,
Representative Emmer,
in response to Representative Wagenius' question, that the answer perhaps is yes when it comes to general assistance benefits, but I believe you're delving into an area that would have to do with health care, and in that case, the answer would be no. It wouldn't affect those health care benefits.
Excuse me, Representative Bradley, can you enlighten us?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Sure, I was just going to say the same thing. If you look at this, it has nothing to do with Minnesota Care, medical assistance, and the other health programs. Those are not changed by this bill.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, if you're going to have a healthy child, it's not just about having the counseling. It's you're going to be eating the things
that have the vitamin C in them, the oranges, whatever, I'm not a counselor, in order to have a healthy child. It's just, I mean, the science is so black and white here. So I want to make sure that this young person who is pregnant in the first 3 months is getting not only the counseling that perhaps you're getting from MA, the vitamins, but also the nutrition that makes healthy babies.
Representative Emmer.
I'm convinced that we're not in a problem here.
Okay. Do you want to respond to that, Representative Emmer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wadini, I believe the answer has been provided, that this is general assistance benefits, and if you have someone who is, in fact, confirmed pregnant, that would be through another public assistance program that's been named by Chairman or Representative Bradley.
Okay, I've got Representative Clark, Carlson, and Solberg. Representative Clark.
Well, just temporarily, just moving on to another. Well, actually, a related question. Representative Emmer, who are we trying to get at here? Why do we need this bill? Who is it that you're worried is going to, you know, need general assistance that during 90 days that you don't want them to have? Who's the target of this?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, as I said at the outset, this is not supposed to be focused on any particular constituency. This has to do with the integrity of all the programs that the state of Minnesota provides and that this legislature is responsible for. As you know, a lot better than I do, there are a lot of strains and stresses on the system in terms of the money that's available to support all these different programs. This is simply an integrity measure that will allow us, hopefully, to maintain all of the benefits that we provide to people that are in need of those benefits.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark.
But you say the words, an applicant who has resided in the state for less than 90 days. So it does have a target. It's somebody who you think doesn't deserve this because they haven't been in the state for 90 days. In other words, somebody who's just come into the state.
Representative Clark, I would choose different words. I never have today, I never have prior today, said someone deserves or doesn't deserve. What I've said, and I will continue to say to you, is that this is about maintaining integrity of public programs. Yes, this is a durational residency requirement that sets a certain period of time that someone must live, reside in this state with an intent to reside here permanently before they qualify. In this state with an intent to reside here permanently before they qualify for these benefits. That is correct.
Well, okay, I guess we're mincing words here, but you're trying to get the person who's been here less than 90 days. You wouldn't deny that, right? You're trying to deny benefits to someone who's been here less than 90 days. In other words, if there's someone who moves to Minnesota tomorrow and would generally, let's say they're mentally ill and need assistance, those persons would have to wait 90 days.
Representative Emmer.
That's the kind of person we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, mental illness or other condition wouldn't make a bit of difference. It would be 90 days. They would have to reside in the state of Minnesota with an intent of staying here permanently.
I think the answer is yes. Okay. So,
Representative Clark.
I just want to check on it, and I'm not a lawyer like you are, but I do have before me some information about the U.S. Supreme Court decision. I think you were referencing the 1999 one, which was, and this decision was, I believe, after the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. I think that was 1996. So this was 3 years later when there was testing of that particular law, and it was in California. There was a test of the issue of someone being in the state for less than 12 months being eligible. So any of those months could have been 1, 2, 3, 4 months, whatever. My understanding is that the court said that the 14th Amendment was being violated by that decision, 7-2 vote, and the reason being, three different reasons. Citizens need to be allowed to move freely between the states. They have the right to be treated equally in all states when visiting. And the rights of new citizens to be treated like long-time citizens of a state are protected under the 14th Amendment. So I'm trying to understand
why we would pass this bill. It's clearly is your idea that we're going to save some money? And do you claim that we will save some money with this?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Emmer.
That was the evidence that was presented in the last committee. Yes, it will save money.
Okay. Representative Clark. Okay, Representative Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the main points that I wanted to cover have been just covered by other people, but I did want to point out that it wasn't me that prepared a fiscal note that said zero savings. I was adding to that by saying that there would be court costs, and that's rather obvious. This will be challenged in the courts, and we will incur costs. So I think members should keep that in mind as they decide whether to vote for or against this.
Representative Solberg. Representative Solberg passes. Any other discussion? Representative Emmer, would you like to make any last statements on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, no. I'd just like to thank the committee for hearing me today. Thank you.
You're supposed to make a longer statement because we have to go and get some people.
Well, Representative Emmer, I'd like to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It was interesting when you, as a first-term member, brought this forward. This is an issue that I worked on as a first-term member, and I think the first time I spoke on the House floor was...
Emmer going to run for Congress, Mr. Chair?
I hope not, because he's in the 6th District. Representative, the 30-day requirement we've got in law is something that came out of the bill that I originally introduced back when I was a first-termer. Representative Emmer.
All I would respond to Representative Kelleher is no, I'm just going to keep running. Period.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you need some more filler yet?
Oh, let's vote, Mr. Chair. It'll be fine.
But let me give you something that seriously, because I want to make sure this is on the record, because there's been an awful lot of talk implying that this is somehow done in a punitive kind of way. I think it can be realistically argued, given the attempts that we are having to try to really provide integrity, which means upfront looking at where people are coming from, looking at documentation, that it does take time to process. And I think it's not unreasonable to think that a three-month time of processing would not be out of reach of reality. And that was one of the things I think that the courts looked at before in terms of time. And I think that there is a case to be made that as we try to be much more careful about the eligibility standards and the verification of those, that maybe it is reasonable.
Representative Bradley, the issue before that was raised by, I think, I can't remember if it was Representative Wagenius or Representative Clark, in terms of someone who was pregnant that came to the state and whether they were covered or not. Did you have any opinion on that particular issue?
Mr. Chair, I think as we said before, this has no effect at all on the health program. So if you need prenatal care, and as a matter of fact, medical assistance actually has retroactivity in it. So this would have no effect. Now, if it's a pregnant woman applying for these particular programs, which, by the way, food stamps are not mentioned, food shelves are not included, those kinds of things that you might need that you can access almost on the first day or very soon anyway, are not a part of this. This is the Division of Work Program and General Assistance.
Representative Wagenius.
Let's call the question. I will do that.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I'll call the question.
Well, I think Representative Bradley was still answering your question, wasn't he?
He'll
move to table the bill. Representative Licavina moves to table the bill. That's a proper motion. It's non-debatable. All in favor of tabling the bill signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed to tabling the bill say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Division.
All in favor of tabling the bill, raise your hands. All opposed to tabling the bill, raise your hands. Seeing 12 ayes and 13 nays, the motion to table does not pass. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question to ask. I had raised my hand quite a while ago. Representative Emmer, there's been a lot of discussion about how the people in the 90 days are not going to get the benefits. Do I understand the bill correctly? It seems like they still do get some benefits, or do they get nothing as the discussion seems to have been?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, this is only general assistance. Other benefits would be available under the current law.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're coming to a close, I might as well, just so it's on record so everyone knows what we're dealing with. As Representative Emmer said, it doesn't matter if they're mentally ill, but the individuals that we're talking about that are on general assistance are people living in battered women's shelters, people in chemical dependency centers, caregivers of incapacitated members of households, needed, people in group residential housing, the people that are unemployable for whatever reason, those that have mental health issues, mental illness or physical disabilities, displaced homemakers, learning disabled. These are the individuals that we're talking about. It's not, we got rid of the opportunity for most individuals that are able-bodied single adults to be able to get general assistance. These are the individuals that have fallen through already every single crack that you can think of, that may have like moved away for a moment and are coming back home, or moved, you know, family moved up here a year ago and got settled in, and now it's time for them to come up here, and I don't think that they should be penalized for that. I don't believe we have the abuse system that we think we do when we're only talking about a couple hundred dollars a month.
Seeing no further discussion,
Mr.
All in favor? I'm sorry, Representative Emmer.
Can we just point out for everybody, because I totally missed it when Representative McNamara asked me the question. If folks will read the first paragraph of the bill, they'll note that, and maybe this is what Representative Clark was getting at, they will get, new folks moving to the state will get 60% of the full standard up to the 90 days, when they will then be eligible to collect the full standard.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman?
Any other discussion? Representative Clark.
Well, would the author tell the committee how much, what we're actually talking about in terms of dollars?
$209.
Representative Emmer, Representative Clark has a question for you.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
I just asked you if you would share with the committee what that means in the individual. Instead of $203, what will they be getting?
Representative Emmer.
I don't have my calculator handy, but I would guess it's somewhere around $120.
Mm-hmm.
Did I do it right? I'm an attorney, and I know you're not. I can only divide in three, so.
No, you divide what?
I like that one.
What did you say?
They only take 33%.
Yeah. Oh.
He can only divide by three, Representative Clark.
That'd be twice what I'm worth.
So we're talking about $121 or so a month that a person is supposed to survive on who is mentally ill, battered woman,
pregnant.
Possibly pregnant, not having yet gone for any care, living in a group home, developmentally disabled. I don't know. I don't know where they're going to find a place to even stay overnight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
I could just weigh in on this for Representative Emmer. In my district, a lot of the people on general assistance, Representative Emmer, are veterans. A lot of them Vietnam veterans especially. And it's sad that this country used to take care of veterans, and we talk so much about how we care about our troops, but then when they come home, we just basically toss them out on the street, and that's going to happen here again with this cut. So I hope everybody thinks about that when they vote.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Representative Rokovina, I don't know about what it's like up in the range, but down south, our Veterans Affairs Officer, which I think there is from basically every county, has a fund to help those veterans when they are homeless, and they do take care of our own veterans, in Martin County at least, and I would assume they have the same thing in everywhere.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, we'll have a discussion about this tonight.
Okay. You're coming.
Because you're wrong.
All right, that discussion will be delayed. Okay. Is there any other discussion that has to happen right now? Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3002, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
With that, members, I'm going to adjourn. Watch your calendar for any other meetings. I don't know if we'll have anything tomorrow now or not. We will on Monday be taking up at least the bonding bill. Meeting adjourned.